I'm used to the idea of dying, but I have no desire to die for the likes of you.
Poor people gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
Startling new numbers out on a growing terrorist watch list in the U.S. USA Today reporting the list now has 1 million entries. That's up 32% since 2007.
This week in Radical History for the week starting March 16th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in Radical History for March 16th, 1811, the Luddites attack machines designed to replace them. The Luddites were a social movement of British textile artisans in the early 19th century who protested, often by destroying mechanized looms, which they felt were leaving them out of work. Since then, however, the term Luddite has been commonly used to describe anyone opposed to technical progress or technical change. Also for March 16, 1933, the last anarcho-syndicalist newspaper, the FAUD, is ordered shut down in Germany. It was started as a union paper for the unemployed in Dresden, in his last journalistic holdout against the Nazi Party. Also on this date in 1965, Alice Herz, an 82-year-old activist, pacifist, immolates herself on a Detroit street corner at the campus of Wayne State University to protest the Vietnam War. Also on this date in 1988 in Iraq, massacre of the Kurds with mustard and nerve gases, which the U.S. and European weapons and chemical companies supplied. Also on this date, 2003, U.S. peace activist Rachel Corrie is killed by the Israeli military.
An Israeli bulldozer killed poor Rachel Corrie as she stood in its path in the township of Rafah. She lost her young life in an act of compassion, trying to protect the poor people of Gaza, whose homes are destroyed by tank shells and bulldozers, and whose plight is exploited by suicide bombers who kill in the name of the people of Gaza. But Rachel Corrie believed in nonviolent resistance, put herself in harm's way as a shield of the people, and paid with her life in a manner most brutal.
Rachel was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer made by Caterpillar Company in the United States while she is participating in a nonviolent movement protesting Israel's illegal 36-year occupation of the Palestinian territories, and specifically trying to save a Palestinian doctor's home from destruction. Eyewitnesses say that Rachel was negotiating with the driver for over 2 hours, was using a blowhorn and wearing a fluorescent orange vest. The driver knew where she was, but ran over anyways.
Rachel Corrie had 23 years. She was born in the town of Olympia, Washington, a skinny, messy, list-making chain smoker who volunteered to protect the Palestinian people who had become non-persons in the eyes of the media, so that people were suffering and no one was seeing.
The following is a short outtake of Rachel in a fifth grade presentation, and also an interview of her right before she's assassinated in Palestine. Rachel Corrie, presente.
My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering, and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us, and we're ignoring them. We have got to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. But we've got to understand that they are us. We are them.
This is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here. People are economically devastated because of the closure of the borders into Egypt and the extreme control of the Gazan economy by Israel. I came to look at the aftermath of a place where 25 greenhouses have been demolished on the other side of Rafah, destroying the livelihoods of about 300 people. And that had taken place while they rounded up about 150 men, held them under a sniper tower, and shot around them to contain the men, the farmers in the area. So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying.
And turn Rachel Corey into a non-person. Oh, but you philosophize disgrace, criticize all fears. Bury the rag deep in your face, 'cause now is the time for your tears.
Lastly on Estate in 2006. My name is Rachel Curry. A one-act play due to open this month at New York Theater Workshop was canceled 6 weeks ago under Jewish lobby pressure in New York. This week in Radical History for March 17th. German-American anarchist Johann Most dies in Cincinnati on this date in 1906. Most, perhaps best known for his thoughts in promotion of the idea of propaganda of the deed, which promotes insurrection and perhaps revolution.
This is your Radio News reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, March 17th, in 1912, American civil rights activist Bayard Rustin was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Rustin's political organizing career was very dynamic. Throughout his life, he protested and campaigned against segregation laws, fought an alliance with the Japanese Americans in U.S. internment camps, organized against British rule in India and Africa, and advocated for gay rights. After adopting a strict nonviolent philosophy, Rustin counseled civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. and helped form the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, from which he was later forced to resign because he was openly gay. Due to his sexuality, Rustin was largely written out of civil rights history, and his enormous influence was heavily silenced. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on March 17th, more white justice in 1934. Thousands of blacks battled the police in New York to protest the Scottsboro trial. The Scottsboro trial originally were 9 young black defendants, some of them were minors, accused of gang raping 2 fellow hobo white women on a freight train. 8 were quickly convicted in a mob atmosphere at trial. The juries were entirely white, their attorneys had little experience of criminal law, and the judge gave them no time to prepare for their cases. As each case went to the jury, the judge would start the next trial while the previous jury was still deliberating. All but one of these black defendants were sentenced to death on rape convictions. Also March 17th, 2 quick items, 1960. President Eisenhower authorizes secret training of Cuban exiles for an invasion into Cuba. And in 1988, U.S. soldiers are sent to Honduras to protect American interests. This week in Radical History for March 18th. In 1871, the Paris Commune begins. For 2 months, Paris was governed by anarcho-syndicalists, local citizens groups known as communes. These lower middle-class folk, disenfranchised because of the war and the ever-increasing disparity between the bourgeoisie class governing from Versailles and the working folk on the streets of Paris. The German-backed Versailles government forces would eventually overrun the Commune's National Guard units. In all, perhaps 30,000 people died, 50,000 imprisoned or executed, and it was reported that well over 7,000 was sent in exile. The Paris Commune of 1871.
On this day, March 18th, in 1969, during the Vietnam War, the U.S. Air Force initiated Operation Menu, and began bombing Cambodia. Despite Cambodia's official declaration of its neutrality, South Vietnamese liberation troops often used Cambodia as a base. After being warned by the U.S. to ban the South Vietnamese from their soil, the neutral country of Cambodia became the target for this massive secret bombing campaign under President Richard Nixon. Over the next 14 months, the U.S. military showered more bombs on Cambodia than the total amount dropped by the Allies during all of World War II. These brutal bombings were hidden from the American public, but the information eventually leaked out, provoking public outrage in the U.S. And then, the government vowed to never bomb civilians again.
This week in Radical History for March 19, 1935, over 100 injured and $2 million worth of white property destroyed as riots break out in Harlem after a black man's eye is gouged out by policemen. New York City Mayor LaGuardia later refuses to release the study which blamed the violence on the police brutality. Also in New York in 1970, 200 women seized the New York offices of Lady Holmes Journal, demanding that they rename the magazine Women's Liberation Journal. The protest was led by groups like the National Organization of Women, Red Stockings New York Radical Feminist, and Older Women's League.
On this day, March 20th in 1620, the Dutch East India Company was established by a group of Dutch merchants and independent trading companies, marking the beginning of their 21-year monopoly over the spice trade in East Asia. They forcefully colonized any territory they desired and often enslaved the indigenous people. Many countries like Indonesia and South Africa are still struggling to recover from the company's oppressive, destructive, and violent legacy.
Also March 20, 2003, Bush and Blair attack Iraq in violation of international law and UN mandates. 24 Tomahawk missiles and four 200,000-pound bunker buster bombs with pinpoint accuracy are fired at Saddam Hussein in a shock and awe attempt to decapitate Iraq leadership. Not one of them hit the intended target. As each, quote, modern war becomes more and more potent, supposedly with more and more accurate targeting abilities, funny isn't how more civilian non-combatants are dying compared to the ratio of combatants. Like this last Gulf War, 1 million Iraqis are dead, double that amount is wounded, and over 4 million displaced. All while the United States casualties only suffered 4,000.
People, the time's come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 21st in 1617, it is said that Pocahontas died in Gravesend, England. Well, let's take a moment to correct Disney's portrayal of Pocahontas. Her real name was Matoaka, and she was the daughter of a Powhatan chief. She would have been about 10 at the time it is said that she rescued the Englishman John Smith. Pocahontas was later captured, married off to a man named John Rolfe, and transported to England, where she was used as propaganda to support the English colonies in Virginia. She died of disease in England at the age of 21. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also, March 21st, 1907, on Honduras, Marines land during war with Nicaragua to protect U.S. interests, like they did in 1903 and will do again in 1911, 1912, 1919, and 1982. Also, March 21st, 1960, South Africa, Sharpeville massacre of 69 people murdered by police during protest of apartheid laws. Also, on this date, 1965, Viola Liuzu, a civil rights worker from Michigan and mother of four, was murdered while transporting civil rights workers after the Selma to Montgomery march. Four members of the KKK would be arrested. One of them was a paid informant of the FBI. During the trial, she was described as a white nigger. This racial baiting tactic worked, for all four would eventually be found not guilty of her killing. Last in the state in 1985, South Africa again. During her funeral march of the three killed in Sharpsville Memorial Demo, South African police killed 19 more innocent people. This week in Radical History for March 22nd, I only have a couple items. 1905 in France, the trial of Alexandre Jacob and his gang began on March 8th, concludes in a guilty verdict. Jacob was a burglar member of the Anarchist Workers of the Night gang, credited with 150 burglaries. The gang was formed with his companion Rose Roux, his mother Marie Berthieu, and others. For 3 years during their spree, they methodically planned their jobs based on railroad networks and schedules, targeting rich people's homes, hotels, castles, and churches. not for personal gain, but with the intent to attack the powerful and rich while creating a forum for disruption of the social world. He'd receive life imprisonment and other members between 5 and 20 years. Lastly, in 1972, Congress approves the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, which has not ratified enough states to ever become constitutional federal law.
They are picking up pieces of their son's skulls in Baghdad. Private forces face no consequences. Private contractors cannot be prosecuted. Puppet governments sponsored by Blackwater, sponsored by Black Gold, shield the company from public scrutiny. Reputations cannot be bothered by trivialities such as fathers picking up skulls on Baghdad roadsides. Booming security industry, business of human slaughterhouses. All takers get contracts in the privatization of war. What employment opportunities exist for 100,000 trained murderers?
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced from the mobile, underground, aerial, and aqua-capable fortress of Glee Glee Studios. I'd like to thank the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York, whose audio I've molested for this show. Since this is the anniversary of the Iraq Insanity, also known as Bush's, no, that's America's Iraq War, I leave this musical treat, Mission Accomplished, by Holy, 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 who is on tour East Coast later this month and West Coast in June. Check out Holy, Holy, Holy at their MySpace music page interface for tour information. Thanks for tuning to this week's little audio missive. And until next week's show, I am always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon. Again, here is Holy, Holy, Holy.
Hotels and surreal palaces populate the roadsides. The country courses with so many blood-red rivers. We tear it down, rebuild it for a profit. We tear it down, rebuild it for a profit. Outsourcing murder, the heart of darkness is black as oil. I do not want to hear about it. I do not want to know about it. I do not want to see it on the news at exactly 6 o'clock.
8 degree arc. I can see must be half the buildings on the skyline seem to be in flames. Really, target has been hit repeatedly. Another white flash.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This morning, our entire program will be devoted to hearing a report back from a trip to Palestine by Nancy and Hubert Murray. They were joined at this presentation at Boston University by Reverend Mariama White Hammond. But because of time restrictions, we will only hear from Nancy and Hubert this morning, and will air Reverend White Hammond next week, along with a very rich question and answer period. Nancy Murray has traveled to Palestine, Israel, some 18 times since 1988, which is why her observations and analysis are so well credentialed. She has led several delegations, including this one, as well as the first one I ever went on in 2001. Nancy is now retired, but for 25 years, she was the education director at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Her husband, Hubert, is an architect who focuses on environmental concerns. He presently is engaged in a project where he is designing a kindergarten to be built at the Lodge Center in the Ida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Here is part one of this unique report back featuring Nancy and Hubert Murray speaking at Boston University.
In November of last year, I co-led an eyewitness Palestine delegation to the West Bank and Israel. And as you heard, I've made many, many visits to Palestine since my first visit as part of a human rights fact-finding delegation in 1988, when the unarmed popular uprising of the entire Palestinian population, known as the Intifada — it wasn't the first Intifada, it was the Intifada — was 9 months old. How different things are today. In 1988, the small human rights delegation I was part of moved around and between the West Bank and Gaza Strip that had not yet been forcibly separated from each other and carved up by walls. Israeli-only bypass roads and hundreds of permanent checkpoints were not yet fully in place. And it was still possible to drive the short distance from the West Bank through Israel to the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza Strip could make common cause with each other. Israeli settlers numbered a fraction of what they do today. But one thing is unchanging, and that is the dehumanizing treatment of Palestinians by a brutal occupying force. More than 200,000 Palestinians would be arrested during the first Intifada, and more than 1,000 killed. In spite of that, everywhere we went in 1988, we encountered hope. Palestinians were convinced that their unarmed struggle would succeed in ending Israel's occupation, which was 20 years old when the uprising began. And everywhere we went, we saw evidence of America's involvement, from Made in Pennsylvania tear gas canisters that caused at least 70 deaths and untold miscarriages during the course of the First Intifada, to the Made in California billy clubs used to break demonstrators' bones. Now, the magnitude, by the way, okay, let's just go back for a second. So those of you who are familiar with the map, you will see in red the places we went on this second trip. So these are the places you're going to hear about from myself and from Hubert in a few minutes. We went from the very south way up to the north, and I'll talk about some of that. Okay, so the magnitude of U.S. financial support for Israel over the years — $137 billion is the figure given in a congressional research report in early 2018. And the supply of U.S.-made weapons to maintain the occupation have grown considerably since my first trip. Now, this shows you — this is from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights website, and it shows how much Massachusetts taxpayers pay every year. You can go to this page, click on a state, and find your share of that $137 billion. If you add it all up over the years, you'll see how much we have paid. This is just an annual figure, $128.5 million is what we paid per year. And just think of what that could do here in Massachusetts. So our military aid now to Israel has grown over the years, and so has Israel's illegal settlement enterprise. Back in 1988, parts of Jerusalem were flanked by settlements, but one could still drive considerable stretches in the West Bank without encountering them. Having observed the settlements multiply and expand over the last 20 years, I was still not fully prepared for the feverish surge in settlement construction and Israel-only road networks, the building up of those road networks, which has been turning the West Bank into a kind of biblical theme park. This has noticeably accelerated since my last visit 2 years ago, no doubt due to the Trump factor. That's an example of the carving up of the West Bank with the settler roads and the walls. But what we saw happening in the West Bank is going for broke Israeli colonization of Palestinian land and confiscation of Palestinian water resources all of which is illegal under international law. And in keeping with the nation state law that Israel adopted as a basic law, which is acts like a constitution, the basic law in Israel. So it adopted this nation state law last year in which it says promoting Jewish settlement is a national value. So that is what it is now doing. It is seeking to impose settlements across the West Bank, seeking to impose the map of Eretz Israel on Palestinian land. Eretz Israel is the Greater Israel, is what it's called, a biblical Judea and Samaria, which is what religious settlers now call the West Bank and what they claim is a divine right. This is an interesting slide. It's an Israeli organization, Levi Ha'olam. The slide website is called Explore Judea and Samaria, and it was set up, it says, to support local Jewish business owners in Judea and Samaria who are suffering because of the anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So when you click on these little hearts, those are illegal settlement businesses. So you can go find this website and look and see all of these businesses they say are suffering. They say are suffering because of the BDS movement. And this shows as well the extent of settlements. The blue dots are the settlements in the West Bank. You may be aware that Israel is an unusual state in that it has no fixed borders, and it never committed itself to specific borders during the so-called Oslo peace process that began 25 years ago. Since Oslo, the number of settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem has tripled to 750,000. And on February 4th, 2009, the Israeli government announced its goal was to settle an additional 1 million settlers in the West Bank, a number that officials have since then upped to 2 million. So they really are going all out now to cover the West Bank with illegal settlements. Today, throughout the landlocked West Bank, Palestinians are corralled into small enclaves by walls, watchtowers, military checkpoints, a road system that bisects the land but is off limits to them, closed military zones, and omnipresent fortress-like settlements that glower over the rural landscape. On many roads, new signage points the way to settlements but omits references to Palestinian villages and towns that remain an obstacle to the full realization of the Eretz Israel vision. And large red signs tell Israelis that their lives would be in danger if they stray into these towns. Can you see what that says? It basically says this road leads to an area under the Palestinian Authority. The entrance for Israeli citizens is forbidden, dangerous to your lives, and is against Israeli law. And, you know, when Israelis actually do go in, they find they're welcomed in many cases if they go in with, you know, because they really want to understand what's happening. That sign is to really strike fear into the Israeli population. Most West Bank Palestinians can no longer enter East Jerusalem, which contains the third holiest site in Islam and used to be the vibrant educational, artistic, medical, and economic center of Palestinian life. All that has been destroyed by the wall that is snaking around and through East Jerusalem. When I first visited the old city of Jerusalem, the main gate to the Palestinian East Jerusalem, Damascus Gate, this is the old city's main gate, was teeming with life. It was where market women from surrounding villages sold their garden produce. The entrance is now nearly empty and sanitized as the apartheid wall has sealed off East Jerusalem from nearby fields and villages, depriving farmers of the ability to access what used to be their economic beating heart. So here, though, This happened just in the last year. The apparatus of dispossession is tastefully displayed. You don't see those huge towers that you saw on the previous slide. Instead, for the sensibilities of tourists, you see this rather more modest tower, and there are two nice stone little army encampments near the old city gate. So Israeli soldiers with their weapons and high-tech equipment are now clustered in these stone encampments and one discreet mini tower, which, as I said, was just erected. They attract little attention from tourists who pose and take their selfies with the Damascus Gate as a background. All around us were signs of what Palestinians call the ongoing Nakba, with the Palestinian presence being diminished, if not erased altogether, through a variety of means, such as home demolitions. Some 44,000 houses in the West Bank and East Jerusalem have demolition orders, and they can be destroyed at any time. And 27,000 have already been destroyed since 1967. So they're living in this feeling of, you know, real insecurity. So that's one, home demolitions, the revocation of permits to live in Jerusalem. 15,000 Palestinians have had their permits revoked since 1967. And 35% of Palestinian privately owned land in Jerusalem has been confiscated to build settlements or to create national parks. So East Jerusalem is really changing. It's so dramatic since, you know, over the 30 years I have been going. As we drove around the outskirts of Jerusalem with the organization Grassroots Al-Quds, we saw where the U.S. plans to build its new embassy, which happens to be adjacent to an Israeli settlement. And we stopped at an overlook. Here's the overlook. Where we could see the settler highway running through what is called E1 to the major settlement city of Maale Adumim. Now, E1, which you see here, this is all the only opening that now connects the north of the West Bank with the south of the West Bank. And Israel intends to basically get rid of the Bedouin who live there and expand the settlement so Jerusalem will be continuous to Maale Adumim and then you're in the Jordan Valley. In other words, cutting the West Bank in two. We see on the next slide here, this has been in the news quite a bit. Tan al-Ahmar, which is a Bedouin encampment, which they're trying to get rid of. There's been a lot of international outcry about it because people realize this is all that's keeping the West Bank from being chopped in two. That is sewage that settlers had dropped or had flushed through the village. This is one of the things they do. And that's not a nice little, you know, clean stream. Okay, I should point out that it is not just the stateless Palestinians of the West Bank who face expulsion from their land. We visited a Bedouin community in the Negev Desert, part of Israel. This is a place called Al-Araqib. These are Israeli citizens. And Al-Araqib is one of 45 what are called unrecognized villages, which have been there long before the State of Israel was formed, but have no water, no schools, no electricity, and do not appear on maps. Now Israel wants to remove them so it can, what they call, Judaize the area. And Sheikh Aziz Al-Tur told us his ancestors have been here for 500 years. He showed us Ottoman registered documents to prove this is their land. Al-Araqib, astonishingly, has been destroyed by the Israeli army 130 times since 1998. And the Jewish National Fund has planted water-greedy but swiftly growing eucalyptus trees in the desert, so they could no longer use their land to graze their animals. And when we were there, some of us in this room visited before when the trees were small. Now they're quite high, and they get watered. A similar dispossession agenda is playing out throughout the villages of the 61% of the West Bank known since Oslo as Area C. This is home to 300,000 people. So it's playing out there. It's also playing out in the largest city in the West Bank, Hebron, where some 1,000 settlers are now implanted in the heart of the old city, turning it into a ghost town. And these settlers are particularly aggressive towards Palestinians. Just to make the point, the grave of Baruch Goldstein, who is a Brooklyn-born settler from Kiryat Arba, which overlooks Hebron, is a place of pilgrimage. Why? Because in November 2004, he entered Hebron's holy site, the Ibrahimi Mosque, and shot dead 29 Muslims at prayer and wounded more than 100. So he is a hero to the settlers of inside Hebron and on the Kiryat Arba, which overlooks the city. Since 1997, a multinational observer force known as the Temporary International Presence in Hebron, or TIF, had been monitoring settler attacks on Palestinians in the old part of Hebron. But last month, following the leak of a confidential TIF report detailing 40,000 separate cases of abuse, Prime Minister Netanyahu ordered the TIF out of the country. And in the UN, the U.S. blocked a draft Security Council resolution expressing regret at the expulsion of the monitors. The settlers now have the green light to complete their violent colonization of old Hebron. Palestine used to be rich in agriculture, but thanks to the various means that are being employed to impoverish Palestinian farmers and drive them from the land, today agriculture accounts for only 3% of the West Bank GDP. And let me cite a few of these means. Settlers frequently vandalize Palestinian homes and olive groves and attack farmers in their fields, often as Israeli soldiers stand by. The destruction of olive trees and fruit orchards deprives many Palestinian families of their only source of income, eventually forcing them to leave their land. Thousands of Palestinian farmers have lost their livelihoods to the $3 billion separation wall that cuts deeply into the West Bank. Many have been denied so-called visitor permits to pass through the locked gates to access their fields and sources of water that lie beyond the wall. Some have permits, but the locked gates are never opened. And if land is uncultivated for 3 years, it is considered neglected land, which can be seized by the state. So that's another means of getting rid of farmers. But the major method Israel has employed to destroy Palestinian agriculture is the weaponization of water. Since 1967, Israel has taken control of the West Bank aquifers and forced Palestinians to buy back their own water. Israelis use, by the way, 5 to 6 times as much water as Palestinians and 10 times more than refugee camp residents. So Palestinians' access to water is well beneath the minimum standards set by the World Health Organization. And for weeks at a time, water taps in villages and refugee camps run dry, while West Bank settlers routinely enjoy green lawns and swimming pools. In addition, Israel destroys Palestinian wells, cisterns, irrigation and sewage systems, and prevents rebuilding. In fact, in this month, they had gone on a real destruction binge in both the north of the West Bank, the south of the West Bank, and in the Jordan Valley, depriving thousands and thousands of villagers of water. Farmers are often prevented from storing harvested rainwater and cannot afford to irrigate their fields by purchasing at the high rates the water that the Israeli national water carrier called Mekorot has stolen from the West Bank. Now, practically everywhere we traveled to in the West Bank, we heard about a water crisis that has forced farmers off their land. And the picture is particularly stark in the Jordan Valley, which was once the West Bank's breadbasket. Now much of it has been sucked nearly dry by the 12 major Israeli wells and Mekarot pumping stations supplying Israeli settlement greenhouses and farms. Most of the Palestinian communities in the Jordan Valley have been declared part of Area C, where building of any kind is forbidden, and many existing structures have demolition orders. We visited the site of what had been a major Palestinian water source, the Al-Wujab Spring. This is, again, in the Jordan Valley. So plentiful was its volume of water, you could see signs of when it used to cascade down the hill. We were told that people would come from elsewhere in the West Bank to gaze on the waterfalls carved into the Arab landscape and have picnics on the banks of its mighty stream. Now no water can be seen, and the spring is totally dry. Nearby Israeli settlements and greenhouses are served by a Mekarot pumping station, that little blue thing there, that pumps 2,000 cubic meters of water per hour from a depth of over 1,000 meters. Palestinians in the Jordan Valley, including in the city of Jericho, are forced to buy their water back from Mekarot at a rate 6 times higher than the amount Israelis pay. Now, this pumping station may look fairly insignificant, but it is a fact, in fact, an engine of Palestinian dispossession and environmental devastation. It has increased the desertification of land, made it impossible for the Bedouin in the region to keep their flocks fed and watered, and killed once flourishing agriculture on Palestinian farms. And sooner or later, Israeli farms, too, are bound to become unsustainable as Mekarot pumps the West Bank aquifer dry. So what happens when farmers can no longer get their livelihood from the land? Now some 120,000 Palestinians, mostly with work permits, assemble at 3 a.m. at transit stations like this one, which we visited in Tilkarem, where they go through this dehumanizing cattle grid, or cattle pen, more like, and endure having their fingerprints taken on a daily basis, irises scanned, and sometimes their entire skeleton scanned, so they can do the dirty and dangerous jobs in Israel and carry out settlement construction. We witnessed, just in the hours we were there, reportedly 20,000 workers passing through this terminal. There are 5 others like it. We were told it could take up to 7 hours to reach a job in Israel. So once they get there at 3 or 4 in the morning, by the time they reach their jobs, it could be 7 hours later. After working all day, they pass back through the cage on their return journey around 7 a.m., and many spend hours then going home. Others who don't have permits cannot go through the terminals, but we were told, enter Israel by climbing over the wall. Now, as bad as all this is, the situation in the Gaza Strip is even worse. And you may know for a dozen years, the tiny Gaza Strip, it's right down there, tiny, home to 2 million people, over 70% of them are refugees. It has been a closed prison. So we could not enter Gaza. But the last time I did was in 2016, and it took me 6 months to get through the permitting process. We couldn't go there, but we did Skype with a young Gazan, Rawan Yagi. This is Rawan. And after talking with her, some members of our group were in tears. We could maybe talk later about the situation during the Q&A in Gaza. But what I want to leave you with now is the fact that the UN has reported that the Gaza Strip will be unlivable by 2020, if it isn't already, and that 98% of its water is not fit to drink. This is a very tiny area, only 26 miles long and 4 or 5 miles wide, where Israel has conducted 5 major military offenses since 2008, killing thousands of people, 800 of them children, and destroying homes, schools, hospitals, and the vital infrastructure for water, sewage, and electricity. And after each aggression, the Israeli-imposed closure has remained in place, blocking the import of much essential building material and forcing many people to live amid raw sewage and often in the rubble of their homes. Now, how many of you know of the Great March of Return? Yes, you've been watching it. Are you aware that it's still ongoing? It will soon be a year old on March 30th. Recently, some of us were fortunate to hear and meet Ahmed Abu Artema, who spoke at Harvard Law School. He is the organizer of the Great March, and he gave us a very clear picture of why the Great March was started, and again, we could talk about that in Q&A. In the early days of the Great March, it reminded me so much of the spirited, unarmed civil uprising involving women, men, and children I had first encountered in the Gaza Strip in 1988, for that is where the First Intifada began, on December 7, 1987. And in the years since then, it can be argued that Israel has been using the Gaza Strip as a kind of laboratory for field testing its new weapon systems and finding the breaking point of human beings. So terrible are conditions there that now that the Israeli historian Ilan Pappé, in his book The World's Biggest Prison, has called what is going on in the Gaza Strip incremental genocide. You might have remembered Rahon Najjar, who was killed. She was a medic, and she was killed while she was trying to save other people. And these are some of the recent images. Let me conclude by saying that this isolation of the West Bank from the Gaza Strip, of one part of the West Bank from another, of one town from another, and of just about all West Bankers from the residents of East Jerusalem, this is a powerful deterrent to the kind of unified civil uprising of the entire society that I witnessed when I first traveled to the occupied territories in 1988. And you can get a sense of what that was like on March 26th. The movie, Nile and the Uprising, is going to be on PBS at 9 o'clock. So I strongly urge you to watch it. So it's different, but this does not mean there is no hope. On the contrary, Palestinians are still resisting and refusing to be dehumanized and defeated, as Hubert will explain.
Thank you, Nancy. And welcome. I want to welcome Kate, who was with us on the trip this last November. So it's great to see you here again.
And Mariam.
And Mariam, of course, but Mariam's going to speak. And also to welcome my architectural and environmental and urbanist friends who are not the usual choir. So it's really great to see you here. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Nancy. Sorry to read all this, but there's a lot of material and a lot of unfamiliar names and places, so it's important for me to have written it down. I'm just going to remind you with this map and the next one of where we went, so you can sort of image Ramallah, Jericho, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, and Nablus far in the north, just to give you a sense of where we're going as we go through this. I'm going to introduce you to many of the people to whom we were introduced during our 2 weeks in the West Bank. And these are people who are not just surviving in the difficult circumstances that Nancy's described, but they're persisting and prevailing against horrendous odds and resisting. And I'm going to categorize these in, there are three bunches. There's agricultural resistance, cultural resistance, and political resistance. So to start with agricultural resistance, the Tent of Nations is a small family farm just a few kilometers from Bethlehem, located in Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank that is under the direct control of Israel. The Israeli strategy is to clear these areas of Palestinian inhabitants, as Nancy has been describing, achieving this goal incrementally by refusing building permits for any structure. 99% of permits have been rejected. Disallowing any natural water harvesting systems, e.g. collecting rainwater from a roof, and allowing the surrounding settlers to cut down olive trees and fruit trees and block access roads. All this and more has been endured by the Nassar family on their farm, encircled now by approximately 60,000 settlers, despite the families having clear legal title to the land, with documentation reaching back to Ottoman and British rule. The Israeli government is conducting a long, drawn-out and costly legal battle in the hope that the family will give up and leave. The Nassar family is not only fighting the government in court, they're determinedly farming their olives and almonds with support from volunteers, refusing to give in. Turning down blank check offers, they say their mother, the land that has nurtured them, is not for sale. As brothers Daoud and Daher each told us, they encourage visits by international volunteers to work on the farm, since that has proven to be the most effective human shield against attacks by the settlers. Because they're not allowed to build, they live and work in a series of 8 caves, one of which you see here on the bottom, and a handful of surface structures that may be physically or legally attacked. Their strategy is encapsulated, cast in stone, with the dictum, "We refuse to be enemies." That you might just be able to read that on the top right corner. Daher explained that if a person starts to hate the people who are uprooting your trees, burning other trees and crops, that hatred can easily consume your life and being. And to quote, "With hatred, we will destroy ourselves." North of Ramallah is the village of Bilin, also in Area C. Bilin may be known to some of you through the film Five Broken Cameras. The curious title refers to cameras used to record the regular Friday peaceful protests against the occupation and the apartheid war, cameras successfully broken by the IDF. After 14 years of Friday demonstrations organized and led by the Bernat family, there are now up to something like 20 broken cameras. The dirt road approach to the Umm Sulaiman farm is littered with tear gas canisters, which you see in a little inset there, and an 8-meter-high, 26-foot concrete wall leading to the farm itself, faced on the other side by the vast and illegal Modi'in Elite Settlement, a dense European-style conurbation of more than 45,000 inhabitants, which you can see in the background over there. The Umm Sulaiman farm is a CSA. Who knows what a CSA is? Community-supported agriculture. It's an initiative started by Muhab al-Alami in 2016. The land was initially annexed by Israel's occupation war, but after a series of weekly demonstrations on the ground and backed up by international pressure in 1997, Israel had to back off about 50% of that land, which was restored to its owners in 2007. One of those owners donated his restored land to the startup enterprise. The economic model is that consumers collectively invest in the crops raised and managed by Muhab and his colleague Mohammed Abu Jayab. They now have 30 participating families, 50 raised beds under cultivation, with a wide range of fruits and veg. The farm lives under constant threat of demolition, and there are 44 demolition orders in Bilin alone. But Muhab takes the view that food self-sufficiency is an important part of the resistance to the occupation. In his words, "We are here and won't give up. We are prepared to pay the price for freedom." Not widely publicized is the prohibition of fertilizers on Palestinian land on the grounds that it could be used for explosives. A beneficial result of this is that many Palestinian farms have resorted to true organic farming, and in that sense are ahead of many of their European competitors in the production of organic olives, figs, and nuts. Now I'm going to turn to cultural resistance. In 1948, the Nakba caused 750,000 Palestinians to be made refugees, 100,000 permanently displaced within what is now called Israel. More than 600 Palestinian villages were destroyed, not only physically, but erased from memory, with a changing of names from Arabic to Hebrew, and the ruins planted with trees to conceal the past. The Palestinian town of Lifta, which you see here, is just outside Jerusalem, and it was one of the few not actually demolished, but evacuated of its Palestinian families. The name has been Hebraized to Mei Naftoa. What was once home to hundreds of reasonably prosperous Palestinian families is now a ghost town, a ruin surrounded by high-density Israeli urbanization, officially proclaimed a nature reserve, and now gradually being repossessed by Orthodox Jewish Israelis who use the ancient spring as a bathing hole. Throughout Palestine, hundreds of villages have been destroyed, their inhabitants dispersed, and place names changed, a technique used by colonists as a means of fully taking possession. Anybody who's seen Brian Friel's translations know how the British did that in Ireland. Now, this fellow you see on the left here is Umar al-Kubari, and he's one of the founders of Zohrot, an Israeli organization dedicated to resisting this erasure of memory and place through mapping the hundreds of destroyed villages, as well as maintaining historical records, written and oral. And as Umar has written, quote, signs serve as a means of occupation, oppression, and erasure. He's sort of pointing this out on the sign here. Palestinians come upon these signs and they feel helpless, made to understand that they're absent, erased. Zohrot, the organization, marks Land Day, March the 30th, coming up, with demonstrations and maintains a website with historical information of the sort that you can't see, you can't read there, a cultural resistance to colonial erasure. Now, the Dehesha refugee camp south of Bethlehem has about 13,000 inhabitants in about 1.5 square kilometers. The Leilac Center is a grassroots organization that invests in the capacity of youth so they can help themselves and their community, combining activism and professionalism. Maji Ali, founder and executive director, talked to us after supper on the roof terrace. There is only one paid member of staff, all the others are volunteers, and it's a strategy designed to resist NGO dependency, as well as the occupation. Any young person is welcome to come for support on any matter. And there is a lot of art all over the walls, all up the staircases, everywhere. It's great. Moving on, the Laji Center is located in Aida refugee camp on the edge of Bethlehem. This is where Yigal is from. Serving a population of about 8,500 in Aida and Al-Azay camps. Aida camp, according to a 2018 report from the Human Rights Center at Berkeley, No Safe Space, found that, quote, the tear gas exposure was widespread, frequent, and indiscriminate, and that, quote, there were no safe places in the camp. The same report stated that Aida camp suffered the most intense concentration of tear gas of any place in the world. In response to this situation and the desperate circumstances in which young people found themselves, the Laji Center was founded in 2000 and has developed programs for community health, for water treatment to make it clean and potable, for healthy diets, and the development of roof gardens, all in an environment where there is food insufficiency and no open space at ground level. Based on a successful music program for various ages and a new playground, Laji is now in the process of developing a kindergarten for preschool children. The founder and director, Salah Jama, is an unpaid volunteer, but the leader for each of the programs is paid a modest salary. Now, the last section on cultural resistance relates to street art. It's all pervasive, and as in revolutionary China or in Paris in 1968, Israel's separation wall is the background for posters and paintings and graffiti that are public newspaper, library, and gallery all in one. What you see from the few samples shown here is that some are quasi-historical and documentary, reporting children killed in the struggle, villages destroyed, and olive trees uprooted. And others are commemorative and laudatory of those engaged in the struggle, past and present. And with that, we transition into political resistance. Art is also the medium for commemoration and compassion. In our walk through the Dehesha camp, we were invited into the home of Abu and Hassan, the parents of Martes, a young man who initiated the demonstration in protest at the approaching death of his imprisoned brother. Martes was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. His parents talked of the great gap that had left in the family. Clearly in evidence, as we looked at the walls of the living room on which were hung mementos and images honoring and memorializing the slain son. Another brother, Hassan, came into the house as we were in discussion. He'd only recently been released from 9 years administrative detention, meaning without trial, and was at first highly suspicious of a group of Americans in his parents' house. Palestinians are allergic to the word USA, he told us. Whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in charge, we have been suffering from their system from the beginning until today. He told us that over 1 million Palestinians have been in Israeli jails. Almost every family has a son or a daughter in jail. The existential pain and anxiety was made especially clear as he told us that on his release, he was warned by the Shabak, the Israeli Shabak, that he would either be rearrested within 2 months or killed. His choice. In addition to the personal, family, and community anguish imposed by the oppression of the occupation, he also talked of the political situation. Existing political parties are weak and ineffectual. We also heard, here as elsewhere, that a dependency on NGOs had created a sort of moral rot from within the community. BDS was considered an important tactic, but no more than that. The only way forward, he says, is through international solidarity with, for instance, black and indigenous peoples in the US and elsewhere, the intersectionality implied in mutual support. Individualism is breaking us, he said. We must get back to our collectivism. It will take sacrifices for the human to be free, but we want humanity to live. We then went to Nabi Saleh, north of Ramallah, so a little bit up the map, to talk with Bassem Tamimi, his daughter Ahed, and Lana Ramadan, a lawyer from the legal group Adamir. The village of Nabi Saleh is in Area C, again, and has a population of only 500, all named Tamimi. They've been exercising non-violent Gandhian-style resistance to the occupation in general and to Houthi militias in particular since 2009, when settlers backed by the army seized their water source. 4 people have been killed since the start of their demonstrations and about 400 arrested. Another 400 have been injured, 40% of them children. Israeli snipers aim to shoot at the knee. Bassem has been arrested and jailed countless times. Ahed, his teenage daughter, you see on the right, described her own experience of being imprisoned, of the callous indifference of her jailers, of her great appreciation of the solidarity of women in jail, and of her renewed determination to become a lawyer and to make connections with other struggles. In response to a question from one of our African-American delegates, her message to black youth in the U.S. was, stay strong, you must fight for all the oppressed, not just for Palestinian rights. And then Lana Ramadan, who is the second from the right in that picture, she's the lawyer from Adamir, and represents about 6,000 Palestinians, many arrested and jailed for minor traffic violations, many administratively detained, meaning held indefinitely without charges and without trial. Charges, arrests, and imprisonments are noted for their capriciousness, a tactic used to keep the population constantly on edge. You just simply don't know whether you're going to be arrested or not. You simply don't know whether your child is going to come back home or not. Her message was, it would be easy to despair, but think of Ahed and her example of strength. We lose people and others get demotivated, but we don't have the option to abandon hope. Then the last visit to mention was to listen to Omar Barghouti talk about the current state of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign of which he is co-founder. In his historical sweep, he talked of the parallels with the boycotting of South African economic products and international cultural and sporting events. And 3 major points he made were, BDS is gaining a lot of traction with the democratic countries, but none with authoritarian regimes. Netanyahu and Trump have managed to associate Israel and the Zionist project with some of the most abjectly right-wing regimes, e.g. Trump's America, Orban's Hungary, and Bolsonaro's Brazil. And then lastly, he said the affinities between black and Native American movements in the U.S. and the Palestinian struggle are strong and can be mutually beneficial in their respective campaigns. Now, this has, necessarily been a very short presentation on the number of places we visited and the people we met and the issues we were introduced to and discussed. But here is a collage of some of those who I've mentioned, but many of those who we didn't have time to talk about. We met farmers and teachers and students and trade unionists and grandmothers and lawyers, a doctor, community health workers, conscientious objectors, LGBT activists and others. We met Palestinians and Israelis resisting the occupation by fighting for land rights, water rights, rights to food, demanding freedom of movement, freedom from arrest, freedom to live, freedom from occupation. And the question you have to ask is, why do these people tolerate talking to Americans when it's the United States that is the supporter and enabler of Israel in their oppression? Time and again, we found that Palestinians can readily distinguish regular Americans, including Jewish Americans, from their government. Quite apart from the human contact, they see it as worthwhile to invest in talking, in representing their case, relying on our ability to represent their case to our neighbors and colleagues and elected representatives, i.e. you. As Omar Barghouti and others repeatedly point out, all they're asking for is that Palestinians should enjoy freedom, justice, and equal rights, just like anyone else.
You have been listening to Nancy and Hubert Murray doing a report back on their trip to Palestine at Boston University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Welcome back to BCFM Politics Show. Me, Tony Gosling. Martin Summers, Marie-Lou Storm, and Afzal Stars Shah is staying with us too for a few minutes. 50 dead and another 50 hospitalised in Australia by a far-right terrorist in Christchurch, New Zealand. Although journalists have garnered all sorts of threats, hate and even a crude manifesto from social media, apparently the Antipodean secret services knew nothing about alleged gunman Renton Tarrant at all. We've heard all about the wonders of self-driving cars. Enter the self-driving Boeing 737 MAX 8. The Ethiopian airliner that came down at the weekend, identical crash to October's Lion Air. What is the so-called stick pusher, which automatically puts a plane into a nosedive, overriding the pilot up to? 50 years after the first flight of Concorde, why have Boeing, the FAA and the EU been so slow to ground this killer airliner? Plus, it's not just Shamima Begum, a phalanx of jihadi brides have now been banned from returning to the UK, even though they were entrapped and groomed online while still kids. Who's making the decisions to strip these women of their British citizenship, and why are MI5 and MI6 afraid for them to return when hundreds of male fighters have returned without even being interviewed by our police and secret services, despite being trained terrorists? And what about David Cameron's secret memo giving our secret services a license to kill? Was Northern Ireland Secretary Karen Bradley right when she supposedly misspoke in the Commons last week, suggesting they're above the law? After all, she's still in her job. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, noon on Tuesday this week. Spartacus Educational's John Simpkin runs through some of Bristol's unsung heroes of history. And from Rhode Island, USA, Professor Vladimir Goldstein gives us a short tour of Russia and Russian literature, as well as pondering over the reasons for Russophobia in the West. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. But first to New Zealand, and thanks for staying with us, Afzal, because I know you've been to Friday prayers today, and it must be on the thoughts of many Muslims right across the world right now.
People are absolutely shocked by the sheer level of killing and the gruesome manner in which this terrorist, for that is what he is, actually took his submachine gun and just calmly went around butchering people in that mosque and pursuing children and not leaving until he could kill as many people as possible. And it raises a lot of questions, though, about the failure of intelligence. But it's good to see that there are media organisations who are calling this individual a terrorist rather than saying that he's got potential mental health problems or that he's a lone wolf. It's just that we have to call it out for what it is. This is cold-blooded terrorism. And I think that's what we have to condemn it for. And here in Bristol, it's great that we've seen so many messages of solidarity and support, people come together. So during these dark, difficult hours, it has actually brought communities together.
It's interesting, isn't it? The BBC refused to call the guy a terrorist for quite a long time until, I think it was the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. Yeah. Then once she did, they said, but it seemed pretty obvious to most people looking that it was a terrorist attack. Martin, I wonder, what is the difference between, say, a lone wolf and a terrorist? And why are some of these media organisations reluctant to use the word, the T word?
Well, we often say alleged shooter yourself earlier. Because, of course, there are legal implications of this. And I think it's to do with, obviously, there's an element of racism. You know, if it's a Muslim, it's a terrorist. If it's a white person, it's an individual actor. But, I mean, don't forget, in this case, he didn't act on his own.
Well, we saw same thing, actually, in the Joe Cox murder, didn't we? Yeah. There's initially a reluctance to call that a terrorist attack.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think this pretty much, if you're going to use terrorism for anything, he didn't act alone. It's a team. Several people have been arrested. There were bombs involved. He didn't just turn up on
2 years in the planning.
Yeah. Indeed. And, of course, the real question behind underlying all of this is who, as we know, on this show we've covered the relationship between terrorism and the intelligence services. We do it as one of our main themes. And there's usually more to things than meet the eye, just as the Manchester bomber was part of this Libyan Islamic fighting group, which had been based in Manchester since the 1980s, had been run by British intelligence to try and overthrow Gaddafi. His father was in Libya at the time he supposedly carried out the bomb attack in Manchester. And most people in this country are blissfully unaware that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group been working intimately with MI6 since the 1980s, as Dave Shaler and Annie Machon, who broke from MI5 over exactly that, will tell you. And most people have got to realise that very rarely is a terrorist act. People in Pakistan will know this, that when a terrorist act happens, there's usually something else behind it, not just crazy people, but military intelligence officers, either Pakistani or Indian intelligence officers. The research analysis wing of the Indian Army engages in this sort of thing. This is the real world. And if we want to put a stop to terrorism, we've got to look at the links
about
that there are.
Talking about Raw, Afzal, I know the Pakistani community here in Bristol has been really concerned about what's been going on in Kashmir too over the last few weeks.
Yes, so people have been very concerned. A couple of weeks back, I organised a get-together because in Easton, a very diverse part of Bristol, we've got the Pakistani Welfare Organization on Stapleton Road, but we've also got the city's only Hindu temple on Church Road, and it was to ensure that we maintain harmonious relationships. So we've had a meeting of members of the Sikh, Indian and local Pakistani communities to essentially show unity amongst each other. But there is concern that in India, specifically because of the right-wing media pandering to the BJP election, which is coming in several weeks' time.
Well, that's right. Some have said that this could be linked to Modi and electioneering because he's soared in the polls as a result of what's happened.
He absolutely has. You saw this back in, I think it was 2003, when he turned a blind eye as chief minister in Gujarat to the killing of thousands of Muslims there. He was actually declared he was actually stopped from visiting the UK, America, many other countries in the West. Here he is now. Whenever he flies over, he's touted as some kind of, messianic figure. And you've seen it with Obama, you've seen it with Trump, you've seen it with leaders in this country, with David Cameron, that they all embrace him. And it's because money talks, but he is And it's interesting that, that the media say he is a nationalist. No, he's not. He is a fundamentalist. He uses, he actually targets and baits Muslims and, in fact, Christians as well, just specifically so that he can build up his vote bank. And he is a hardcore Hindu fanatic and recently targeting Pakistan in the election. His figures have actually soared.
It does seem to me, Martin, that we seem a lot of these the faiths used in this way, Islam and Hindus, actually many of the leaders that are using those words, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Hindu, actually don't actually bear any relationship to what the people of faith believe whatsoever.
Well, I mean, the problem for all human beings is the problem of sin, if you like, Tony, is that people can take the most marvellous things, religion or socialism, if you like, that can, you know, secular socialism can be turned into a monstrous evil by the wrong people. And I'm afraid that's just the problem that human beings have, isn't it?
I mean, we've seen in Australia, for example, the Catholic paedophile priest. I mean, this is the perfect place. The church is the perfect place for wicked people to hide as well sometimes.
Well, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So everybody pretends to be virtuous, but that obviously not everybody is.
I should say that given the recent tensions between India and Pakistan, which are both nuclear-armed states, the Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, all of these defence contractors, Boeing as well, their shares rocketed because they knew that India will now spend billions and billions and billions. So on the one hand, you've got Trump calling for peace between these two countries, but on the other hand, you've got these defence contractors lining up and flying out to India and saying, you know what, if you really want to beat the Pakistanis, buy from us. You've also got Israeli industries as well saying that buy from us because we've got the best counterintelligence machinery available and learn from us in terms of the way that we've been dealing with the Palestinians. You can also deal with the Pakistanis in a similar manner. However, what they fail to recognise is that this has global impact. God forbid, if something happens between these two countries, it will have an impact globally. It's not just that there will be nuclear fallout between these two countries, it will affect the whole world. And I think we cannot do enough. And I think it's very sad that that the United Kingdom, which was sadly responsible for all of this in the first place, has not taken a more assertive role. But that's because we are so focused on Brexit, everything else we've lost sight of.
Martin, let's look at Kashmir for a minute then, and the history and the partition when it came to independence for Pakistan and India. This was a particular region, Kashmir, which many people said should go into Pakistan, but it stayed with India. And that's been almost a running sore ever since. Has there been really attempts to sort that out? Well, and it's almost like the British did this deliberately. I don't want to mean to be too much of a conspiracy theorist here, but we did the similar sort of thing, the British Empire in the Middle East, where we're drawing lines specifically to create future tensions.
Well, it's very complex, as you can imagine. There's a lot to be said. If we were going to go into it, we need a history seminar.
Well, you mentioned, I think, last week, something about having a referendum.
In theory, there was going to be a plebiscite, because the majority in Kashmir were Muslim, but the Maharaja... but the Maharaja of Kashmir was, a British puppet, and he decided to go with India, and it was kind of because don't forget, it was all done in a hell of a rush. Mountbatten wanted to get the whole thing done as quickly as possible, and of course, Afzal may disagree. Maybe he can come in, but it's either a cock up or a conspiracy. But either way, it's ended up a hell of a mess, hasn't it?
So the Maharaja Hari Singh, in terms of signing the instrument of accession, is clearly shown that he wasn't there. He was travelling to Srinagar from New Delhi. There's no way that he could have signed it on the 27th. It was shown that it was signed 24 hours later. Yeah. So there is a lot in terms of the way that this seems to have been stage managed. Mm-hmm. And also the Indian troops were airlifted in to Srinagar. It was essentially a takeover. Yeah. But I think the key thing is now that bilateralism really has failed. You need a third-party mediator to clash heads. And also, I think it's actually criminal about the United Nations, because what have they been doing? they have a moral responsibility and a legal responsibility to actually ensure that they're honest brokers. But all they've been doing is just saying, oh, we need peace, we need peace. And I think that we forget there are, you know, United Nations resolutions talking about the plebiscite. Mm. And there are innocent people who are being killed on both sides. And we need an honest broker, but we also need the Kashmiris to be at the negotiating table.
Yeah, well, absolutely. What do you make of Imran Khan now as leader? Has there been a difference in the character in Pakistan?
Imran Khan has got class. I mean, so I like the way that he's handled this situation. You can see the difference between Modi, who has, you know, come out and being very aggressive, but you've seen Imran Khan, who's actually reached out with an olive branch in. He took the opportunity to release the Indian pilot as a gesture of goodwill. But every time Pakistan has actually offered an olive branch, India said, no, we want you to renounce any claim over Kashmir, and then we'll come to the negotiating table. And we should not forget that since 1989, over 100,000 innocent Kashmiris have been killed, many of them in fake encounters by the Indian military. And I should add, why do you need 750,000 soldiers in the Kashmir Valley? It is the most heavily militarized place on earth. It's not North Korea. It's Indian-occupied Kashmir, which is the most heavily militarized place.
It's not a million miles away. A few thousand miles away, anyway, Martin, is Myanmar or Burma, where we've seen fascinating power plays going on there with the Rohingya Muslims being given arms and supplies by Saudi Arabia. And then, lo and behold, the Israelis turn up and help out the Burmese government. And that helps to fuel the conflict. So you've got the Saudis on the one hand. It does seem as if Muslim communities all over the world, I mean, particularly in that region, it's not just the Middle East we're talking about, are being targeted too with these divide-and-rule tactics, where actually the only real winners are the arms companies.
Well, I think that's it. That divide-and-rule sums it up. Don't forget, a lot of the people behind what's going on are students of classical ancient history, and in actual fact they do read their ancient history, and this is what goes on. There was manipulation.
So which books are they reading? The same books as
Tacitus.
Yeah. Same books as you. Yeah.
You create a wasteland and call it peace, all of that. I mean, most of the critique of imperialism is there as well.
Sounds like divide and ruin, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's the problem is that, to my mind, a lot of this stuff has become so ingrained that it's not even cynical, it's just irrational. You know, they do it because they can, and it's not even going to get them what they want.
Well, it is. It's going to make lots of money from arms sales. Anyway, Afsal, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I completely agree with you. And it is a case of divide and rule. You have to look at Mountbatten, Radcliffe. That's exactly what they sought to actually do. If they were going to leave India, they were going to leave it in flames. And you see this 7 decades on. And although India's economy is increasingly liberalising, and we pander to Modi when he comes to the West, I think that there is a moral obligation on the West to ensure that they use all their soft power, to use all their approach with India and the United Nations and the European Union, but also with the Commonwealth.
We have a problem,
though,
don't we?
We've not said anything about the Commonwealth yet.
For many people, actually, war makes more money than peace.
It absolutely does.
Well, yes, and of course it's not to be seen in isolation either, because we've got this. But don't forget, after the 9/11 attacks, which we discussed last week with Ian Henshaw, there has been a power play by the Western powers to try and stop rising powers from taking their crown, specifically the Chinese and the Russians. Of course, the Chinese are in alliance with Pakistan They're hoping to build infrastructure to bring
CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is part of the One Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah. Which, of course, that shouldn't be seen as a threat by India or the US. This is an opportunity for everybody to prosper if it's approached in the right way, isn't it?
Italy wanting to become a member of OBOR with China just earlier this week, and the Americans have actually got very angry about this. But actually, going back to India, the Americans are very keen for India to contain
China
alongside Australia, alongside Japan. So they want to form this group of four, the Quad Four, the quadrilateral four, to essentially contain China. But what they fail to realize is that the Chinese have actually, they themselves are actually modernizing their own forces, their own military, their own economy. So I think, sadly, all this money being pumped into the industrial military complex, it's just creating a more of a tinderbox situation. And the only people who lose out are those who those poor impoverished people, such as those in Burma, such as those in Kashmir. And I would say once again that Kashmir really is a stain on the conscience of the British psyche. Over 70 years, and no attempt has been made by Britain to try to get this resolved. And I think that's an absolute shame.
I mean, one of the really appalling sides of all of this, thanks very much for staying with us, Afzal, is to discuss that, is the way that the press in Britain has covered a lot of this, or not covered it, so to speak. And I did promise a few weeks ago, as I noticed on the BBC World Service, there was an admission of the links between Chatham House and the US intelligence services. So when you hear someone from Chatham House coming on the BBC, as they do all the time, talking about international affairs, where do they really come from? Let's have a little lesson. It's only a short clip from World Update on the BBC World Service now.
Well, we can speak to Matthew Page now, Associate Fellow at the think tank Chatham House, their Africa programme, formerly the US intelligence community's top Nigeria expert. So, Matthew, thanks for being with us.
And there he just said it. The top CIA's top, well, he didn't actually say CIA, US intelligence community's top Nigeria expert, now Chatham House. So there's a sort of revolving door, Martin, isn't there, between the intelligence services and what we're getting on the BBC as so-called independent experts.
Yeah, it's quite interesting this week. They approached the Ministry of Defence have approached various universities, including Cambridge University, to help them with their psychological warfare programme. And they even said to Cambridge University that they would help them with dealing with any negative publicity that the university might get from being involved in such a programme. And a senior person from the science History of Science, I've forgotten his name now, but he's often on TV, and he said, well, I'm glad this has all been knocked on the head, because it's very bad for the reputation of the university to be seen to be involved in this sort of thing. But they're still out there looking for a university. I understand Lancaster University are now thinking that they might be involved in the psychological warfare programme. And,
this is just mind-bending, isn't
it? It is. Really? What we're talking
this
about
is a professional lying. Remember, we had Bill Pottinger faking these videos, which were then used all on the TV in Iraq.
Yeah, well, it's what they call strategic communications. And, of course, what it means is basically using so-called independent media, or what people think is independent media, the BBC, for example, as part of a psychological warfare programme to, for example, take out Maduro in Venezuela, where we're hearing all sorts of disinformation about what is and what is not happening. And you know, there's a massive amount of media out there now, but a lot of the mainstream media are bought and paid for, either by corporations or by governments, but less so on this programme, folks.
Yes. We're not, folks. No, we're definitely not. Anyway, I thought maybe we ought to have a look at this whole business of the jihadi brides, particularly since I did an article about Shamima Begum back in 2016, citing Turkish press reports that Canadian intelligence had actually recruited Shamima when she was age 15 from a school in East London, Bethnal Green, and brought her over to, I mean, it's basically online grooming using Facebook, that sort of thing. The guy that had done it had been promised by the Canadian government that he would get a Canadian passport out of it, Martin.
Yeah, and isn't it extraordinary that of all the fuss there's been in all the media in Britain about this girl and a baby dying and all the rest of it, and whether she should be allowed back or not, the obvious thing that hasn't been pointed out, she was groomed online when she was underage, and the person who was grooming her was not from ISIS. Well, he was from ISIS, but he was working for the Canadian intelligence services. And if people think back to 5-6 years ago, our intelligence services were getting people from all over the world to go to Turkey and then be sent into Syria to overthrow the evil government of Assad, who had won the democratic election in Syria in 2012 in very difficult circumstances, and he looks as if he's won the war. And of course, if these people come back and are put on trial. They're either not put on trial at all, as you say. They just come back and blend in.
Okay, just hang on a second. Hang on a second, Martin. Sorry,
this is going to come out.
Hang on a second, because it was. I thought it was quite interesting. Who is it exactly that makes the decisions about who comes back and who doesn't? Because that was revealed at the weekend on Radio 4 by Rory Stewart, who, of course, is a former Bilderberg attendee. He's also chair of the Defence Select Committee. He's now prisons minister, but he led it slip at the weekend on Radio 4, who makes these decisions.
There are reports that two more women in Syria have been stripped of their British citizenship.
When these decisions are made, the security service is involved, the intelligence service is involved. These are very, very serious processes that take place. As you know, I spent quite a lot of my life working in Iraq, been in Syria. I can not emphasize enough just how horrifying and disturbing Daesh, the Islamic State, was, and that the action of these people going to join it was done open-eyed to join a state which has been responsible for some of the most extreme atrocities known.
Well, the fact is that the Western intelligence services, working with MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, were bringing people from all over the world.
We were told, the point here is, we were told
to infiltrate them into Syria.
Syed Javid, the Home Secretary, had made this decision. Of course, he's just making it because MI5, MI6 are telling him to.
That's right. And of course, they, as Thierry Masson, the French journalist who's based in Damascus, has pointed out, they don't want any of these people to come back. They either don't bring them back at all, like in this case, or they brought back, like, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group people who were allowed in and out of the country without any kind of checking at all because they're working with the Western intelligence services. And most ordinary people in this country do not realise the intimate relationship that there is between the jihadi terrorist networks and our own intelligence services. Well, and in Syria, it's absolutely clear what's been going on. They've been trained by our own special forces to go and fight Assad, and then we call them terrorists, okay, even though we've trained.
Let's have a look at some evidence of that anyway. Terror trial, this is back in Monday the 1st of June 2015 in The Guardian. Terror trial collapses on fears of deep embarrassment to security services. Swedish national Berlin Gildo's lawyers argued British intelligence agencies were supporting the same Syrian opposition groups as he was. The prosecution of a Swedish national accused of terrorist activities. So, Martin, that's another case.
Well, that's right. That was a case in the... and that's pretty clear. That was a case in the Old Bailey, and they said you've been in Syria, you've been working for ISIS or whatever the group was he was working with, and his defence lawyers argued, well, yes, but you basically recruited him. The MI6 are supporting exactly the same group that he's claimed to be a member of. And, of course, at that point, the trial dropped. Now, the other thing I would point out about people who have been carrying out terrorist acts inside Syria is they ought to be extradited to Syria, even as British citizens. And that surely should be what happens if they've been engaged in terrorist activities inside Syria.
Well, there's some more stories as well. I mean, that's just one. Moazen Beg was freed after a terrorism case against him collapsed. Secret intelligence material handed to prosecutors demolished the case against former Guantanamo Bay detainee.
Well, Moazen Beg had basically been cooperating with MI5, and then what you do is the problem for people who cooperate with intelligence services is they can hang you out to dry at any point. You think that you're like this Canadian guy thought that he was working with Canadian intelligence. He wasn't Canadian. He was may have a Canadian passport. I can't remember. But the fact is, if you do deals with these people, they've got power over you, and they can just get you killed. They can, you know, hand you over to people. At one stage in the rendition process, for example, the Syrian government, before they became, you know, put on the naughty step, they were extraditing people from all over the world to Syria to be tortured by the Syrian police so that they could then pass information back to the Western powers. And, of course, if you play games like that with people like that, you end up getting burned. But the whole thing is much more complex than people realise. And, I mean, I think in Syria, I mean, for example, it just came out not that long ago, the chemical weapons inspectorate have said, well, in actual fact, there wasn't a chemical weapons attack in Douma. That was staged by the White Helmets. On the basis of that, we carried out several missile strikes inside Syria. And, of course, what the Syrians and the Russians could have decided to do is fire back at the RAF base in Akrotiri and kill your service people. if you're going to kill our soldiers, we're going to kill your soldiers. Just because they've got white faces, they bleed the same.
OK, we've also got a British double agent who plotted to kill his MI5 handler and attack the UK after infiltrating a jihadist group in Syria. An MI5 agent allegedly recruited by a terrorist mastermind in Syria, then sent back to Britain in a plot to launch an attack against MI5. An undercover operation was launched to try and track any similar plots. Scotland Yard has arrested the man and he remains in police custody. Now, that's also in, it's a couple of years ago, that was in 2015. The agent was recruited by MI5 as an undercover informant within the radical Islamic community. He then travelled to Syria when he became part of a jihadist group and apparently double-crossed his British handlers and tried to return to London with plans to launch an inside attack on the capital. I mean, this is, they're playing with fire, Martin.
Well, they are playing with fire. At the very least, you could say they're playing with fire and then they get burned. But it's worse than that. I'm quite sure that the Syrian intelligence services, the Russian intelligence services, the Iranian intelligence services and the Irish police force are very well aware of how the British intelligence services work, which is basically they've got their finger in every pie. And I understand we might be discussing some of the issues, for historic issues from the Irish conflict before the end of the show, but that's the real world. Don't presume that these are the good guys and that they are on your side. They're not accountable to us. They're accountable to shadowy forces we don't really understand, and they're engaged in all sorts of double bluffs and triple bluffs. It's a much more complicated picture than people imagine.
Okay, well, we've got one or two other similar sorts of cases. David Cameron also gave MI5 agents apparently a licence to kill in a secret letter saying that they should not be prosecuted for their crimes. MI5 agents authorised to participate in murder, torture and sexual assault, yet no police officer or prosecutor has ever been told of their criminal activities. A secret letter from the former Prime Minister David Cameron was made public. Now, this was all around about 2018, last year, but it's only just become public, Martin. So it does seem as if what Karen Bradley said, which I'm about to play, what she had to say, may even be, possibly even be true, that there is this real... And it was interesting at the time, as the DUP guy was sitting nodding behind us, so maybe they're in on this idea that you've got a kind of... hit squads of secret police that are able to kill with impunity in this country. So let's have a listen to what Karen Bradley, Northern Ireland Minister, said last week.
Over 90% of the killings during the Troubles were at the hands of terrorists. Every single one of those was a crime. The fewer than 10% that were at the hands of the military and police were not crimes.
Well, I mean, this is in relationship to this one soldier F who's going to be... They're going to dump the whole Bloody Sunday thing on him. And of course, in actual fact, the people who should really be in the dock is not the individual soldiers who did the shooting, but Colonel Robert Ford of the Parachute Regiment, who gave the orders, because it was an actual fact, and it wasn't just a random thing. Bloody Sunday went on for 20, 25 minutes, and lots of people were killed, and it was actually planned in advance. And, of course, as Karen Bradley pointed out there, only less than 10% of the killings were carried out directly by the army, but Brigadier Gordon Kerr... was running the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland for many years, and he was going to be put on trial by Sir John Stevens for running the Loyalist terror campaign. In other words, everybody killed by the Loyalists was ultimately being killed by the British Army, as everybody in Ireland knows, actually, but most people on this side of the water are blissfully unaware. They think that we're fighting jihadi terrorism around the world when we're actually funding and supporting it from the 1980s onwards, and they thought that the British Army was there trying to keep the two sides apart in Northern Ireland, when in actual fact they were 100% behind one side and against the other. Now, these kind of techniques... I've been going on for years, but because of the war in Ireland in this country, there's an awful lot of people who have a great deal of understanding of how this stuff actually works. In the US, people have a very, very limited, and I dare say in Switzerland, people have a very limited understanding of how these operations are carried out. In this country, we've had a 30-year civil war, and lots of information has come out for those who've been paying attention about how these kind of operations are conducted.
Now, I hope on the line sort of right now, Martin, we're joined on a separate story, but linked, as they usually are, by Roger Sanders. Can you hear us, Roger?
Yeah, I got you, yeah.
Okay, Roger, I know you live close to Fairford in Gloucestershire, don't you? Can you just tell us what has been going on up there this week?
We've got this week's been arriving the whole flight, half a dozen, eight or so of the American B-52 Super Fortress bombers.
What is Fairford Air Base and what's been going on up there recently?
Okay. Well, Fairford Air Base, for the last 10 years or so, it's been almost redundant. But then a few years ago, it was expanded considerably under sort of NATO agreement, NATO financing, which increased it into a standby type of facility. Now, off and on, we get these huge planes come, you know, and they were used from Fairford during the Iraqi war, and they were also used from Fairford to bomb Serbia in the former Yugoslavia problems. Now, every time they, well, not every time, but a lot of time they come in, it's almost a signal that something's going to happen. The concerning thing is this time, we've got eight of them come in this week, and then they're usually backed up by the B-1, and I don't know for sure, but by the B-1 bombers as well.
So are you a bit of a plane spotter, Roger? You're a bit of a plane spotter yourself?
Well, I just know about planes, yeah, I am a bit of a plane spotter, yeah.
So what the Americans, I imagine, will be saying is that this is just another NATO exercise, Roger.
It is a NATO exercise, and the I mean, what I'm concerned about is these huge aeroplanes flying directly over our town of Stroud, you know. If anything happens, God forbid, forget the possibility of any sort of strike or anything, but if anything happens to one of those planes and they come down in the vicinity of Gloucester, Cheltenham, Stroud, it would be absolutely horrendous. And they fly directly over our town, they fly directly over my house, which I'm not being that self-sufficient. It's my house, but they fly directly over lots of built-up areas. Now, coming and going, it depends, I think, on the wind, what have you. But the concerning thing is this time is to do the NATO exercise, which is taking place in Georgia. And Georgia, of course, is the former Soviet Union. And how I see it, it's so-called defensive thing, but I think it's also part of the saber-rattling against the Russian sort of build-up, you know.
Can you just give us an idea of what's been happening with the development? You're saying that it's been expanded at Fairford recently.
Yes, it's been expanded several times. I think in one time the actual runway was expanded. It could take full size aircraft. I mean, it was a test bed for Concorde when they were flying Concorde. So it would take the largest aircraft, you know, whatever size, whatever shape, whatever dimension, whatever they're doing. So it's a huge runway. The facilities is huge facilities which are left from the Second World War, and as I said, it's been made redundant, come back into force, been redundant, back into force. But it's been a NATO standby facility for several years.
Do you actually see much of the US Air Force personnel at all around the area?
No, very, very little of it. I mean, if you go to science, we're like 10 or 12 miles in a straight line from Fairford, which on a flight path, of course, is considerably close. But we see nothing of the... because as they come and go, they bring with them their backup teams. Now, evidently, in the next 2 years, they're going to build up a force of American military workers, we'll call them, for want of a better word, to service the facility. And there's something up to 2,000 Americans due to move into Fairford in the next 2 years.
Well, Roger, thanks very much for joining us. A little update. I haven't heard much about that on any of the nationals. But Martin, a whole load of B-52s turning up in these massive old Vietnam-style bombers up at Fairford.
Yeah, well, but by far the most likely relation, this is definitely Russia-related. It could be that they're going to go for a simultaneous kind of conflict in Venezuela, in Iran, and in Ukraine, Georgia. It seems crazy, but these are not necessarily rational people. And if you're going to go to war, you might as well go the whole hog. Yeah?
So you think this is all Russia-connected potentially?
Yeah, well, if it's based in Fairford, it must be. They could be related to the Middle East, but they probably... I mean, don't forget, they flew from Fairford to bomb Iraq, because we went down to protest, if you remember. We went down to protest every week for several weeks before, because it was quite clear what was going to happen. And then they flew and they bombed Iraq from Fairford.
And on Dialect on Tuesday, we've got an interview with a chap called Vladimir Goldstein in the US. He talks about Russian literature, but one of the things he also mentions in the interview, and that's on at noon on Tuesday, you can hear, is the... that EU leaders are not really showing very good leadership. Would you agree with that? He's saying that they really should look more towards Russia in the east than they're looking all the time to America. The elites
in the west are over a barrel because the Americans make sure they are. I mean, the French General de Gaulle kicked NATO forces out of France.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. Why did the British have to accept these B-52s here?
Well, we are probably closest to the Americans of all the European countries. Don't forget, France and Germany did not want to go to war in Iraq.
We're physically close, but what about the political? Why does the British government have to say, yes, you can have your American bombers based
here?
They used to call it the unsinkable aircraft.
Well, that's right. We're Airstrip 1, as George Orwell used to call it in 1984. We are definitely their little bulldogs. And that's why de Gaulle didn't want us in the EU originally. And, of course, de Gaulle kicked all US military bases out of France in 1960. And if we're talking about independence and sovereignty, there's no foreign military bases in Switzerland, is there? There's none at all. And that's what independence looks like.
Yes, we're a colony, folks. But anyway, let's have a listen to Vladimir Goldstein now as he explains a little bit about why the European Union, Brussels, and Europe generally should be thinking a little bit more about having better relations with the Russians, because we don't really want to have a war in Europe sparked off by the Americans.
It's more or less a question of EU, and I think they don't have, for the time being, they don't have sort of very solid leaders. Basically, it's the task of the leaders to assert themselves in Europe and say, you are more than happy to deal with America, but we also need to deal with Russia, because, you know, they are very neighboring countries. You can just, you know, much easier to trade and whatever. And I think what will send finally a message to Europe is the China, which will, you know, to trade with Europe, it has to go through Russia. So I think, you know, this geography is more or less becomes inevitability and the fate. So Europeans will have to be integrated. You know, we can be rest assured that the United States, it's not in their interest. They are more or less removed from this center of action. So they would still try to come, and I think this, for example, the Ukraine story is one of the ways to split, you know, this inevitable process of merging. But it's the only thing it can do is slow down. We see how sort of, you know, nobody's interested much in Ukraine. It's a corrupt country, and eventually Europeans will say, okay, either you become part of it, stop your hostility, stop being, you know, a buffer between the two countries, and get integrated into this big trade between Russia and Europe, and get on with it, or just be kind of abandoned country like some kind of Rwanda in the middle of Europe. But I think, of course, the United States will try to exploit the situation, keeping Poland and keeping, you know, Russia and Ukraine as some kind of a split between Europe and Russia. But I think they will merge eventually, you know.
Well, I mean, there's clearly a geopolitical struggle going on for the soul of Europe, if you like. The Germans, for example, are ploughing ahead with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will bring natural gas from Russia to Germany at a cheap price, which they will then sell on to other European countries. But, of course, the Americans are very hostile to this. They're saying that they're going to bring sanctions against the companies which are involved. And they are trying to break up this kind of potential marriage, if you like, between Russia and Europe. And, of course, historically, Switzerland has been independent. They're not in the United Nations, I understand. Although it's based in Geneva, Switzerland is not even a member of the United Nations, because that's been the culture going back to the Middle Ages.
Can you explain that? Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
I mean, remember when people said no, voted no for the EU, but twice at the same time there was the votation for the being in the UN. So the first time they said no, but the second time they said yes. So they are in the UN now for I think almost 10 years now. But the thing is, I mean, it took them something like 600 years to be a confederation, and I think that the main point for them is that the confederation and all the cantons work together and work well together. So they're a lot more focused on, you know, on their territory. But we have a Department of Foreign Affairs, which is quite powerful, but in its own way. I mean, the sense we used to have I can't remember her name now, but we used to have this lady at she was the head of the Foreign Affairs Department, and she used to travel a lot, and she was asked to be the mediator in a lot of discussions, a lot of negotiations. But this is something which we don't really hear about. This is, I mean, we hear about that in Switzerland, but it's not really well known all around the world. There's no press about it.
Right, forgotten history. Mm. What about the Swiss? Let's be a little bit critical now, because it's nice to hear the Swiss are very wonderful and independent now, but we've seen world wars swirling around the Swiss, and they're kind of standing there rubbing their hands. You can almost imagine somebody singing Edelweiss up on the high mountains watching the money coming in from the wars.
Yeah, yeah. As I said, I mean, banks are quite free to do whatever they want. I mean, there's no close look at what they do. I mean, this is really a private banking system. So for, I mean, till the UBS affair, I mean, they were really, really free to invest in what they want. And
we have this thing with legendary numbered Swiss bank accounts.
Exactly.
So money can be paid from those accounts to a hitman, and no one can trace. There's no names involved. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was reading recently that some Swiss accounts that you can have as a British person, for example, you can't find out what your balance is. You have to pay for somebody to fly to come and see you, and then they have an encrypted laptop. They open up the encrypted laptop, and then they show you your balance, and they close it, and then they fly back again, because there's an immense amount of secrecy involved still with the Swiss banking. But you've also got there the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. I'm not sure if you know much about that, but I was looking at that recently. That's the central banker's central bank. So Mervyn King, when he was, and Mark Carney, these people all going backwards and forwards to Switzerland. This is where all the central bankers meet. And one of the fascinating, there's a great book called The Tower of Basel by Adam Libor, all about that bank, who we had an interview with him on here a few years ago now, probably. He was saying that actually the Swiss government has got no jurisdiction. It cannot go in and arrest anybody in there or investigate anything inside this central banker's central bank. So between, Martin, I'll ask you this one, between London and Basel, where is the belly of the beast, really?
Well, I think what happens is, because Switzerland, it's to do with geography, they were the first to break out of a feudal setup because the geography allowed it. The Google War.
William Tell or what?
It's that sort of era, yeah. And of course, because of the geography, they were able to pioneer sort of democratic forms and so on. But of course, they then became the headquarters of the international bourgeoisie, where they go to do their business. That's why Davos is every year in Switzerland. Where else? And of course, it became an obvious place. Geneva, the Geneva Convention. I mean, there's a positive side to this as well, that they became famous for mediation and so on. But at the same time, they also, I mean, there can't really be a legitimate reason for the level of secrecy in Swiss banks. Mm-hmm. There can't really. I mean, that level of secrecy is bound to lead to abuse, because it's just obvious that it will. Why can't they be transparent? I mean, the tax authorities in Germany and Italy are furious because all their money ends up in Switzerland, which is why, of course, you've not had any cuts in your austerity in Italy and elsewhere. People are sleeping in the street, but not in Switzerland.
Well, there's some people sleeping in the streets, but there is another system for charity. I mean, all these rich families, of course, are giving money. We don't know about it, but they're giving money to open shelters and open free restaurant for these people. But the main thing which makes me really feel like, okay, there is a kind of other debate in Switzerland, if the people actually are trying to have this initiative for the Swiss government to tax more rich people, but not for opening private banking system and to make it transparent. What they are saying is, okay, you are rich, you have to pay more taxes. That is the people's claim, but the people don't really claim for opening the banking system to make it more transparent.
Well, can I just talk about something a little bit more positive, and that is that in Bristol tomorrow there's a training session for the Extinction Rebellion movement, so people will be coming from all over the country to get trained up on how to get involved in direct action of one sort or another in order to, I suppose, make politicians, make the press and make the public sit up and take notice about what it is that's messing up our environment particularly. But there's all sorts of other implications to this too. And I'll put a link up to where it's all taking place. I believe it's £20 to go along or something like that.
Just pay what you think you
or
can
pay
afford.
What you can, anyway. Now, George Monbiot said it was £20.
So yeah, but that's the official. If you just turn up and you haven't got £20, they'll let you in.
Okay, so anyway, so Bristol is to host a national mass rebellion training event tomorrow, hosted by Extinction Rebellion. It will teach non-violent direct action up to 1,000 people at a time. Now, the sort of workshops that they'll be doing here in the city are along the lines of, well, there's something called the Solution Zone, showcasing local and national solutions to the crisis. The Gallery, art themed around the ecological crisis. The Art Factory, Let's Make the Rebellion Beautiful, to create much of the large art banners which will be used from the 15th of April onwards. And the Sanctuary, a regenerative culture space. And I suppose that's where, if you've had a hard time during the day, you can chill out there for a while and enjoy that. But anyway, so that is, you know, quite nice positive things happening in Bristol tomorrow. And like I say, I'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and wish them all the very best of luck with that. But Martin, we must go back, I think, to talk a little bit about Northern Ireland, because there are several stories relating to that. You mentioned it briefly just now, but we've got a rather horrendous situation with these two journalists who did a book about the...
It's a film.
Sorry, a film. You're right, absolutely right. A film about something called the Lochan Island Massacre.
The Lochan Island Massacre.
And which is supposed to have been done by loyalists. Just explain that.
Well, this film is called No Stone...
During the Troubles, the Irish
Troubles. Yeah, this film is called No Stone Unturned. And it was made by ex-BBC journalists, but they made it as an independent film.
The BBC wouldn't let them, no doubt.
Well, they started working with the BBC, but the BBC then said, no, we don't want this. They went off to do their own film.
Do you remember, actually, that's the sort of thing that's happened quite a lot at the BBC over the years, where someone turns up to work on Monday morning and find the entire office
disappeared. Courtier, but anyway, so they've made this film, and the film basically it was in 1994.
So the journalists are Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burney.
Yeah,
and let's have a before you carry on, let's have a listen now to their solicitor, Niall Murphy.
Okay.
6 months to the day since both Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey were arrested in a police operation arising out of what we consider to be a malicious investigation in relation to the documentary No Stone Unturned. 6 months on, we are no further, and police today applied for an additional bail condition which would seek to restrict both Trevor and Barry from making public comment in relation to this case. That application was farcical, preposterous, and was robustly challenged by myself and Mr. McCaffrey's solicitor, John Finnegan. The application was ultimately refused by the adjudicating sergeant, and the position that currently stands is that they have been bailed now for a further 6 months, so that will be a total of 1 year on police bail for a case that doesn't exist. There is no theft, there is no complaint of a theft, and that police have taken investigative action arising from this film and have arrested the two people that seek to tell the truth about the circumstances of the atrocity in Lochan Island is a farce, and it's a malicious farce.
Well, just as I was about to explain before, you had that clip of the solicitor of one of the journalists involved. Yeah, the The massacre took place when people, it was in Lochan Island in north of Ireland, the Irish football team were playing the Italian football team, and people went to the pub to watch the match as well they might, and the loyalists turned up with machine guns and killed five people in the pub. But anyway, the police knew almost immediately who'd carried it out. There were the loyalist paramilitaries from the Ulster Volunteer Force, but nobody's ever been arrested because they were basically being protected by the police, and that's what this film... The police promised the relatives that there would be no stone unturned to catch the perpetrator, and then they protected them. So nobody's ever been arrested or questioned in relation to this massacre, even though it's pretty obvious that the police
sounds
knew from the get-go.
It sounds a bit like the Guildford Four in the Birmingham
Well, except this is the opposite end of it. These people are being protected rather than singled out. Now, of course, what the film has done, it's many years ago now, but they've interviewed everybody, they've gone back through it, and they've made a film which shows that the police were basically protecting right-wing terrorists. Yeah,
that's what the biggest criminals in the Troubles may have been the police.
Well, there's another film which we may cover another week, which is also out there, showing that the police were actually trying to encourage right-wing terrorists to kill more innocent people. And of course, that's when Karen Bradley, who didn't even know what the difference between a nationalist and a loyalist was when she was made Northern Ireland secretary.
Maybe that's why she was made Northern Ireland.
Well, maybe
secretary.
It's why she's made Northern Ireland secretary. She doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. Now, in actual fact, going back over all this stuff is not going to bring anybody back.
Maybe we have a look.
But people
at that
do need
week,
to understand what really happened. It's not just the wicked old IRA going around blowing things up. Also, the loyalists have killed lots of people, and the British military were running the loyalist paramilitary campaign.
Finally,
that's
Martin.
That's pretty clear.
Finally, we're going to look at the Ethiopian Airlines ET-302. A bit of deja vu with the Lion Air crash last October. 157 dead this time, 189 dead last time. Two nosedives within 10 minutes of takeoff. Boeing has refused to ground the type. It's now finally, I think, done it after Trump told them to yesterday. We've had a week with these planes flying around that are basically death traps.
Well, I mean, you know more about aviation than I do, Tony, and what you've been suggesting, we were talking about before we came on air, that this is a software glitch which should have been ironed out before they flew.
The thing is that Boeing tried to hide from the pilots what this system does, which it takes over. What it does is it pushes the stick forward in old-fashioned terms, so that if the plane looks like it might stall, that is to say run out of airspeed, it puts the nose forward in order to try and make it pick up speed. But what's happening is the pilots haven't been trained in how to switch this thing off when it goes wrong. And so they're panicking as the plane does a nosedive at full speed with the engines on full throttle down into the deck or to the sea. But finally, thank God, these things have been stopped from being used. But I'll put a link up to a great article by, Moolam Alabama, I think it is, which talks about all the safety implications of this. The automation depends on only one sensor, which is crazy. So, time to sign off for the Comcast News at 8 now, American-owned. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Afzal Shah, to Martin Summers and Marie-Lou Storm. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing weekend. Martin Summers is back, thank goodness, now. Do please join us for the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are celebrating Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. We're featuring today a keynote speech given by independent journalist Abby Martin of Media Roots and the Empire Files. Abby Martin also penned the foreword for Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. Her talk from February 27 as part of Social Justice Week was titled Critical Media Challenging U.S. Empire. Abby Martin talks about the state of media and propaganda, particularly regarding the events unfolding in Venezuela. On the Project Censored show today, a special episode with Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Think about crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Abby Martin of Media Roots and, of course, the Empire Files. Abby Martin also penned the foreword for Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. That's our latest book. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. She was recently part of Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. And Sonoma State University in Northern California is where Project Censored was founded by Carl Jensen in 1976. Since then, Peter Phillips, who ran the project for many, many years until I became director in 2010, has now been, for the last several years, putting together an entire week dedicated to social justice issues. On today's program, we're sharing with you one of the talks from this year's Sonoma State Social Justice Lecture Series. Abby Martin was the keynote speaker and gave a talk on critical media challenging U.S. empire, where she talks at great length about the propaganda surrounding U.S. involvement in Venezuela. We now share that talk with you.
Now I'd like to introduce Abby Martin. She is an anti-imperialist journalist, founder of Media Roots, former member of the board of directors at the Media Freedom Foundation, Project Censored, and the creator of the Empire Files. Please give her a round of applause.
What's up, you guys? Thanks for coming out tonight and supporting this important event and Social Justice Week and for supporting Project Censored. It's an incredibly important organization. It's how I actually got my start in media. I saw Peter Phillips speak, and I realized that if you're not getting involved in becoming the media, then you can't get your issue out. It doesn't matter what your issue is. Mine happened to be war, imperialism, and empire. And that's just what generated me to do what I'm doing today. So thank you so much again. It's an incredible honor to be here. My name is Abby Martin. I am the creator of a show called The Empire Files, which used to be on a Latin American network called Telesur. It's a conglomerate of Latin American states. Unfortunately, the show got shut down because of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela in the past year. So we had to go independent. And in the abysmal state of media, I think that's just the route that a lot of us are going now, where we're funded by donors and we're really just grassroots from the people's perspective, from the ground up. So what we do at Empire Files is we analyze issues using the U.S. empire as a starting point, because I think every issue is really rooted in the heart of the empire. Here we are in the heart of the empire. We try to reclaim these narratives that have been set by the colonizers, imperialists around the world, right? How have these regions been shaped by empire? And every domestic issue we try to analyze through the understanding of U.S. empire as well. How are all of our resources squandered from the U.S. empire, from military spending? Why can't we afford health care when every other country in the world pretty much has that for their people? And we're spending more than the next 12 countries combined on our military spending. There's too many bases that the Pentagon doesn't even know how many bases that there are. There's things called lily pad bases that they can't even account for. So I think the number right now that we know is 800 military bases around the world. It's the largest empire the world's ever seen. And you don't hear about this on corporate media. You don't even hear the word empire being used. People think I'm talking about Star Wars when I explain what this government is doing around the world. It's pretty fascinating, kind of the historical amnesia and ignorance from the American public about what their government is doing around the world. I mean, just the interventions alone, usurping the democratic processes of countless countries. Looking at Latin America alone, the number is near 60. And I'm going to focus my talk tonight on, of course, the ongoing coup and how the media is really becoming just a completely subservient to the ruling class and painting the propaganda framework for that coup. You know, none of these things are allowed in the corporate media. The corporate media frames and limits the parameters of debate, a very lively debate within those very select parameters, of course. But you just don't hear about these things, right? You don't hear about the fact that half of this country is living paycheck to paycheck. You don't hear our politicians even talk about poor people here. So it's a dire state, right? And I think it's as time goes on and as corporations become stronger and more consolidated, we're just seeing less and less media space for alternative outlets to really have a voice and to provide that clear perspective that's so crucial and so needed.
So I was going to talk just generally about, you know, how the corporate media serves empire. And we're just in the middle of one of the most egregious coup attempts in modern history, kind of coup by tweet in the social media sphere. And I think it's really important to focus on how the media is specifically manufacturing consent for war in Venezuela and use it as a case study for fake news, which Trump has kind of hijacked as his own term. And I think understanding the media line in Venezuela can help us understand more about how the corporate media functions, how it's an essential instrument for the U.S. war machine and its proxies around the world. I woke up to corporate media censorship during the Iraq War. The propaganda was all intensive. It was wall to wall, and it was all consuming. But there still was this lingering fear of terrorism. There was still kind of the periphery, that deep-seated fear. You know, 9/11 was still fresh. It was only a year and change previously that 9/11 had happened. This makes much less sense to me. Venezuela poses zero threat to the U.S., but for some reason, we've kind of all bought into this notion that we're a benign force that tries to help people, even if it's led by Donald Trump in this kind of humanitarian mission. So it's just as uniform, though. Even though the propaganda doesn't stick as well as it did maybe during the Iraq War, it's just as blatant, perhaps even more so. You know, and compare, just really quickly, compare the coverage of Venezuela to Gaza, an actual dire humanitarian crisis, 2 million people caged in, 95% unpotable water. They don't have electricity. How is that not a humanitarian crisis? Are we not talking about invading Gaza to save and liberate the people there? So you really have to ask yourself when you're hearing these tropes, like, what does that actually mean, this humanitarian crisis, this notion that these people need to be saved by Western intervention? Look at Yemen. This is a humanitarian crisis that's the gravest in the entire world. We have tens of millions on the brink of actually starving to death, and that is being facilitated by the U.S. empire. So it's grotesque. The hypocrisy is grotesque. And, you know, it's so strange to me that the corporate media has this kind of faux dissent against Trump's domestic policies, but they've lined up to support this coup. And every time there's issues of war and peace, every time we're talking about militarism or expansion of empire, that's when the corporate media really comes out in full force to fight Trump from the right. You can look at withdrawing from the nuclear treaty that they called him weak for, that's setting us on the path of nuclear war with Russia. That he's weak for doing that. Or you can look at the fact that they were hammering him for talking about removing troops from Korea. Somehow they're arguing that we still need troops in Korea. So they were fighting him from the right on that. And then look at Syria, right? That was when he became president. That was when Trump became president, when he bombed Assad. So it's pretty astounding, isn't it? And every media outlet across the board paints the same picture about Venezuela. It's a starving nation. People are eating zoo animals, rats, and their pets, right? It's a brutal dictatorship where protesters are getting arbitrarily gunned down in the streets. And there's no democracy, and that's why this guy Juan Guaido is reclaiming democracy. This is a democratic measure to reinstate democracy in the country. But before we go further into these points, let's look at who, again, who is leading this coup attempt? Donald Trump, reality star billionaire, xenophobe who calls Africa a hole, implemented a Muslim ban, the most bigoted, misogynist, racist, who's carpet bombing the Middle East. This is the man that Democrats in the media called unstable, potentially the next Hitler, yet they're lining up to support his quote-unquote humanitarianism in Venezuela. Mike Pompeo, he's an apocalyptic madman who thinks the rapture is nigh. This is a guy who just went on Fox News and declared Hezbollah is in Venezuela. Iranian cells are in Venezuela. And what did Fox News do as a response? They just printed it. Confirmed. Confirmed. Well, Mike Pompeo said it. Well, that's confirmed. Hezbollah in Iran, in Venezuela. And then you have John Bolton. This is an Iraq war architect. Extremely dangerous neocon. He declared, with zero evidence, that Russia and Cuba were arbitrarily executing people on the street in Venezuela right now, like cells, you know, these agents from these hostile nations. Just stunning. Just stunning bullshit. And then, of course, we know that the troika of tyranny, where this is not just about Venezuela, this is about Cuba and Nicaragua and completely reshaping and recolonizing Latin America at the behest of U.S. corporations and militarism. And then I think the most comical person involved in this is Elliot Abrams. He led the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez with the Bush administration. He is a literal war criminal, and I'm not mincing words. He literally is a war criminal. He hid weapons and aid shipments during the Iran-Contra scandal. He facilitated genocide. He funded right-wing death squads. I mean, it's cartoonishly brazen to have this guy back in office overseeing the current coup instead of being chained to a dungeon wall for eternity, which is where he should be. You'd think that Donald Trump leading this gaggle of war criminals would be a cause for concern for people. People would maybe question the notion that, maybe this isn't about humanitarianism at all. But no, the corporate media is lined up, as well as Democratic progressive darlings in the administration, to basically support the propaganda framework again. So even though you see Bernie Sanders saying that he opposes military intervention, he's still saying Maduro needs to let the aid in. The aid is a mechanism for regime change. That's the second stage of the coup. So it's very disconcerting to see even the most progressive people in Congress buying into the propaganda and actually helping the coup be facilitated. It's a disgrace, frankly. So let's look at the media's promotion of the coup and the major justifications for the coup. Dictatorship versus democracy. Maduro's a dictator, right? Juan Guaido is the president. He's the interim president, and he's saving democracy. Well, what's weird about this, I think the weirdest part, is that the opposition making this claim won their seats through the same electoral process that Maduro won. So I guess the elections are only rigged when the socialists win, not when they win seats. So that's always just been kind of a funny thing. I mean, Venezuelan elections have more checks and balances than most countries in the world. As a matter of fact, they're certainly more democratic than our elections. They are heavily monitored by independent observers. And in fact, the opposition called the UN to not come and observe the elections in 2018, which could have proved alleged voter fraud if they actually came. So that's very fascinating. They did not want the UN there to observe the results because, of course, the opposition wants to declare these elections illegitimate so it can bolster the claim that Maduro is a dictator and the elections are fake. So they boycotted the process. They boycotted the process. They refused to run. They refused to vote. And one of the opposition coalition members, Henry Falcone, actually disrupted that plan. He did put his voice in the ring, and he immediately got expelled by the MUD coalition in Venezuela and threatened to be sanctioned by the U.S. government, literally threatened by Mike Pence and Donald Trump for running in an election. That's really amazing. So they are too fragmented. I mean, the opposition's too fragmented to win. That's why Maduro won, right? And they can't kind of galvanize themselves to win. So they keep trying to usurp and reclaim power by violent, undemocratic means. And it's pretty scary because not only are they boycotting the elections, but there's armed kind of violent wings of the opposition that go and actually attack and intimidate voters and attack polling places. And in the last election, there were 200 polling places that were attacked, 10 deaths. So there was a lot of intimidation on the ground to try to prevent this process from going through. But at the end of the day, Maduro won. He won with 6.2 million votes. And he trounced the next person in line, which was Henry Falcone. He actually won with the same percentile that Barack Obama did in eligible voters. We're talking about 6.2 million votes in a country of 30 million with 20 million eligible voters. That's a lot. That's a lot given the economic crisis that exists, given the pressure on the country. It is difficult to live in a country that's under siege by the U.S. empire. That is why people are leaving. That is why people still leave Cuba. It's not easy to live under economic embargo, of crippling sanctions preventing crucial medicine from reaching you. That's difficult. So there are many leftist, progressive socialists within the opposition. It's kind of unfair to paint the opposition with this broad brush and claim that they're all violent, they're all far right. But the opposition wing that is trying to take power right now is the far right. The second that Juan Guaido declared himself president, he immediately tried to not only expel CITGO's board, the state oil company, he tried to immediately pass a new hydrocarbons law, mass privatize the oil, which is odd.
because I thought this was like a starving nation that you wanted to go in and save, and immediately you're just doing legislation to privatize the oil. It seems like a weird set of priorities if you're really trying to go in there and save the day. Who is this guy? He's a 35-year-old man who's much more well-known in the elite circles of Washington, D.C. than he is in his home country. 80% of Venezuelans had no idea who the hell this guy was before he appointed himself king. He studied under an IMF director at George Washington, and him and his mentor, Leopoldo Lopez, in the country were heavily backed by U.S. regime change fronts, the National Endowment for Democracy, and USAID. By 2010, international agencies such as these were pouring $50 million a year. $50 million a year into funding the opposition movement in Venezuela. Think about how much money that is. Think about how far-reaching that can go. So this is what the CIA does now. They use these non-governmental organizations to foment the discord and the radical discontent that they blame people like me doing in this country, that they're paying Venezuelans to do to try to overthrow their government and to create that quote-unquote humanitarian crisis, which I'm going to get into. So, you know, the day before this happened, no one was involved in this. There was only like three other people in Venezuela who even knew about the plan and that were working with Guaido to do this. So it was kind of a surprise to a lot of opposition people as well that he even declared himself president without really their backing. But he got the green light from Mike Pence, and that's pretty much all he needed. The day before the coup, he got a call from Mike Pence and said, "We're with you. Go ahead." As the White House explained to the Washington Post, quote, "We've been engaged with the same strategy in Venezuela, to build international pressure, to help organize the internal opposition, and push for a peaceful restoration of democracy. But that internal piece was missing. Guaido was the piece we needed for our strategy to be coherent and complete." Well, sounds like a pretty open and shut case of regime change, CIA plot. Like, we can all go home now. I mean, how ridiculous, how brazen is this? That they're actually just telling the media, yeah, Guaido was exactly what we needed to make this complete, to get our coup off the ground. But again, you're not hearing any of this on the media, right? The media that allegedly hates Trump, the fake news that's trying to take him down. And let's talk about this notion of an international community, this kind of coalition of the willing. That's what we heard during the Iraq War, remember? How many nations supported the U.S. in their invasion of Iraq? Well, you hear the same thing today, that the international community supports Juan Guaido. Well, oddly enough, when you look at what that international community is actually comprised of, it's mostly just white colonizer imperialist nations or former empires that support Juan Guaido, or U.S. allied Latin American countries. Africa, every single country in Africa except Morocco does not recognize Guaido. Every single country in the Middle East except for Israel does not recognize Guaido. Every single country in the Caribbean except for the Bahamas does not recognize Guaido. And it just goes on and on and on. And so it's just quite disgusting to actually have those voices erased, to not talk about the brown, black populations of the world and what they think about this coup. So I've always just been really disgusted by that. So let's go on to the next kind of talking point here, which is validating our intervention here, which is Maduro's security forces are crushing dissent and wantonly executing peaceful protesters on the ground. Well, that couldn't be further from the truth. There are huge anti-government protests that stretch as far as the eye can see, hundreds of thousands of people filling up giant square blocks, right? We've all seen that with our own eyes. Zero government interference. I was there. We've seen it. I don't think any of us can really claim that we've seen those protests be interfered with by the government. Now, there's another side of the story here where there are armed, kind of blockaded wings of the protests called Guarimbas. They are violent. They are armed with Molotov cocktails, grenades, and bombs. And they do create a lot of violence. They burn down food distribution warehouses. They invade maternity clinics. They're attacking schools, hospitals, pretty much anything that can represent the Socialist Party and represents an enclave of the state, they will attack it. The second that they found out that I was working with Telesur on the ground, they threatened to lynch and assassinate me, and I had to flee the country. This is what they do. They consider Telesur an enemy, part of the enemy, because it's affiliated with the state, and there's been multiple coup plots that have been uncovered that actually had Telesur as a target to be firebombed and taken out if those coups did indeed go through. So Telesur will, in fact, be targeted if Juan Guaido and the coup does succeed here.
And it already has been targeted, of course, by the sanctions that we don't really care about.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're listening to a speech given by independent journalist Abby Martin at Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. This was in February, on February 27th, earlier this year. The title of the talk, Critical Media, Challenging U.S. Empire, where Abby Martin talks in detail about the propaganda surrounding U.S. involvement in Venezuela. Special thanks to John Bertucci for the recording. After this break, we'll hear more from Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Telling the truth, exposing the lies. Think about the past, focus when you're driving your ride. But people die for the all, and Daddy Bush's revenge. I'm with the widows, the children, and the lonely best friends. Time for families, staying together as one. I'm not for the raids and the deportations. I'm with Victor Thoreau and the MIR. So watch out for them snitches in their unmarked car.
So I was there, you know, I saw with my own eyes these protesters basically commandeering giant 16-wheeler trucks, pulling people out, burning them, setting up these huge street blockades. And that's pretty much where the majority of the deaths are. Whenever you see these statistics, you know, 140 protesters dead, they make it seem like Maduro's going around and ordering the death of these people, which is also interesting because when cops kill people here, do we say Obama's thugs went out and shot protesters? Like, no, you don't affiliate what the police are doing with, like, direct orders from Trump or Obama. So that's bizarre already, right? Like, the talking point doesn't make sense, but it also is just false. First of all, Caracas is the most crime-ridden city in the entire world, so a lot of does happen, and there is a lot of violence. It's very dangerous, and that is hand-in-hand with just the economic crisis. Inflation is sky-high, it's, you know, shortages of food, it's a difficult place to live. And so there is a lot of crime. And so these people kind of use the protests and carry out a lot of violent activity under the cover of kind of protesting, right? And I interviewed these people because a lot of these people are just glorified. I mean, everyone from Vice to MSNBC can go and embed themselves with the guarimbas, and they're all like masked and, you know, making Molotov cocktail factories. And they just like pretend like this is necessary because these people are pushed to desperation enough that, yeah, they're going to throw Molotov cocktails at the cops when they're going through this, right? But none of these people actually talk to them. They just put a microphone like, why are you throwing Molotov cocktails? Why do you have a grenade in your hand? And I spoke to one of these people who actually was holding a grenade, and he said, I can't be an entrepreneur. Think about that. I said, why are you holding a grenade? He said, I cannot be a business owner here. So that's kind of the mentality. It is a class struggle. It's very, very kind of viscerally, like, there's a very visceral racial dynamic of the opposition. It's a lot more white, affluent. It's the revolt of the well-off. And when you look at kind of the history and legacy of Hugo Chavez and subsequently Maduro, you understand that they are black, Afro-Indigenous Venezuelans who have uplifted millions of people out of poverty that were rendered invisible by the same class that wants to take back that power. So I wanted to just say one more thing about this notion that Maduro's killing people in the streets, and I wanted to use a media example to show you just how this works in the framework of the corporate media. CBS News, January 22nd to January 25th of this year, as the coup was really exploding, 40 people died, 40 people were killed. Now, if you're watching the corporate media, you would take away that Maduro ordered police forces to go and just assassinate protesters, just arbitrarily, right? What's amazing is when you look at this, oh, and CBS actually did say, they literally came out and said, quote, after last week's mass unrest, when security forces killed more than 40 people, that was a CBS quote. Now, amazingly, it's such a bold lie that they actually contradicted themselves in another article where they said the UN believes 40 died in different manners, including 12 killed by incidents related to looting. I was like, wait. Okay, so that's different. First, you said 40 people were straight up killed by police on the orders of Maduro, and now the story is changing to 40 people died. We don't know how. Could be crime, could be looting. Weird, right? So then I looked at the actual UN report, because of course, again, they're claiming that like either Maduro security forces are pro-government gangs, go and like wantonly kill people in the streets. So when you looked at the actual UN report, it said it could have been armed gangs, either pro-government or otherwise. I was like, well, that's fraud as hell. So it could have been anyone, basically. Like, I mean, it's just so disingenuous when you really try to dig further than the headline, and even dig further than that, like actually see the reports that these people reference. And even if the UN did say, we got reports that, you know, these many people died by pro-government gangs, I mean, a lot of these sources, not only being fed to the corporate media, but also these non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are being fed by opposition people. The Chavistas are ignored. Opposition people, again, they are much more well-connected. They have a direct kind of line to the non-governmental organizations. They directly work with the U.S. government. So, of course, they're going to be way more presented in the corporate media. That's just like by default of their presence, right? And I've talked to several Chavistas who will die for the Bolivarian Revolution. They'll die for Maduro. And they told me, we don't exist on the corporate media. They said, revolutionaries don't exist. And thank you for telling our story, because there are millions of us. And again, there are millions and millions of people who believe in this movement. It's not necessarily about Maduro. He is a surrogate for the Bolivarian Revolution that Hugo Chavez started, and that Maduro is simply carrying on. And they believe in that process. They believe in that process, and that's why they voted to continue that process last year. So it's pretty disgusting. Again, I hate to keep calling out Bernie Sanders and others who are basically saying that the last election was undemocratic and calling for new elections. They just had elections. They just had elections. So again, you're playing into this kind of propaganda where you're saying, oh, they need to do this. No, they don't need to do anything at the behest of you. They're a sovereign country. They have their own constitution. So stop telling people what they should do and bending the empire and its military to bend these other countries to your will. It's grotesque. It's absolutely grotesque. So now let's look at the final notion that this is a humanitarian crisis, right? That's what we're told. With authority from pretty much everyone across the board, that there's a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, and that's why we need to intervene. What's surprisingly absent from this discourse is testimony from the actual UN human rights investigator that was designated to investigate the said humanitarian crisis. His name is Alfred de Zayas. He was the first UN investigator to go to Venezuela in 21 years. I interviewed him on Empire Files. It's an incredible interview. I mean, he's been ignored by every single mainstream news outlet. He has written 21 reports for the Human Rights Council, and he wrote the definitive report on Venezuela. And the findings are astounding, because it really just flies in the face of everything that you're being fed by the mainstream media apparatus. Not only does he outline how this coup is just a brazen violation of international law, but he also talks about how the sanctions and the economic embargo that were implemented by first the Obama administration in 2013, and then the Trump administration, which really has ramped it up to a completely unseen level, where he put, I think, 70 new sanctions on Venezuela, of course, before the coup even happened. But that is what has really stifled and asphyxiated Venezuela's economy and really prevented it from recovering. Of course, you can't uncouple the economic crisis with the price of oil. I mean, Venezuela is a country that is 95% or even more dependent on oil exports for its revenue. And oil took a free fall a couple of years ago, and their economy just completely went into free fall at that point. And here's the difference is that obviously a country as rich as Venezuela and as resource-rich as Venezuela would be able to pick itself up by its feet if anything like that happens. The thing is, because of the economic embargo that was implemented, you have to trade oil in U.S. dollars, so that was impossible. They couldn't absolve their debt. They couldn't take out loans. All of those things were stifled for them. And not only that, but other countries that they may do deals with were then threatened with sanctions if they did help Venezuela. So how were they supposed to recover economically? That's just the prevention of recovery, right? And then you look at kind of the genocidal nature of what sanctions are. Sanctions are war. Look no further than the 500,000 babies that died from dysentery-related illnesses during the Iraq build-up to the Iraq War, right? The first Gulf War. Madeleine Albright said that was worth it. That's what these people think. 500,000 kids is worth it for them to expand their hegemony around the world. That's sick. Sorry, I get really upset because it's just insane to me that this is happening again and we're just going along with it. But these sanctions are genocidal. Alfred de Zayas talked to me about what the sanctions have actually done. And it's pretty stunning. In 2018 alone, 300,000 doses of insulin were prevented from being delivered to Venezuelans. Tell me if you know any diabetics who can survive without insulin. $1.65 billion blocked for the payment of food and medicine. $7 million for dialysis treatment for children. That's the nature of these sanctions. They're not for corrupt government officials. They are affecting and hurting the most poor, vulnerable Venezuelans that are then being used as a cynical talking point, as a precursor to invade and to military intervene. I mean, it's really cynical. And when you start to kind of realize this egregious inhumanity and immorality of the economic war, you realize how fake the notion that we care about humanitarianism in this country. Let's just talk really quickly about what happened last weekend. There was this insane escalation at the border. Of course, you know, the coup has been attempted for the last month. It has been failing. The resilience of the Venezuelan people is profound. Again, they've been trying to overthrow this government since the election of Hugo Chavez, and they have failed dozens of times. Think about how crazy that is. Pouring $50 million a year to try to create this revolution within the country. Imagine how much money, like if Project Censored were given $50 million, imagine what we could do with that. I mean, it's just crazy that that shows you how strong the people are. I mean, the resilience of the people is just unbelievable. The fact they have resisted this effort, and they've resisted this latest effort as well, despite, again, the fact that a lot of people are upset. The economic war is very real. Anyone who's honest about Venezuela will tell you, yeah, it's not that there's a mass shortage of food. There's shortage of particular food items, flour, toilet paper, toothpaste, butter, things that are very crucial to make daily things for Venezuela. And so, yeah, it is hard. People are leaving, but it's the people who can afford to leave. And so, again, they're using the people who support Maduro, which is the poor masses, as the reason, as their tool for this entire regime change mantra. Now, what happened at the border was stunning. And we're talking about tech giants, too. I mean, I saw every hour there was another Twitter moment where it was like, what happened at the border? And so you have Marco Rubio alongside the Latin American allies, you know, Ivan Duque, the president of Colombia. He's another proto-fascist who's with Marco Rubio at the border with Juan Guaido, their little puppet, staging this concert with Richard Branson. Like, what in the hell was that? That was nuts, right? But here they are. Here they are at the border. By the way, the bridge on the border that they were trying to say that they were going to let this aid in was like an unused bridge that hadn't even been finished built yet. But the media was just circulating it saying, look at how crazy this dictator is preventing this aid from coming in on this bridge. It's like, well, first of all, this is a hoax. The bridge isn't even in effect. So why are you doing this? But also, all right, let's talk about what happened at the bridge over the weekend. They lined up all of these USAID trucks. By the way, the Red Cross will have nothing to do with this. They call it a political stunt and a faux kind of attempt for regime change. Now, that's pretty crazy, because we know the Red Cross is not like a radical organization here. I think if the Red Cross is not wanting to, not to do something, you should probably take heed of that. So Marco Rubio, his little fascist cabal at the border, just trying to foment this like hysterical crisis, right? They tried several things. First of all, you have John Bolton trying to encourage defectors from Maduro's army. He's like, he's literally trying to bribe them. He's like, we will give you money. We will not sanction you. Please leave the army and defect. So the first thing that happened on Saturday, I think it was, because they gave him a deadline. He was like, if you don't let the aid in by Saturday, then like we're gonna make it come in whether you like it or not. So it was like clear, blatant threats of a war escalation. Then you know, U.S. military is built up in Puerto Rico and other staging grounds to basically just openly threaten Maduro. So three armored vehicles just charged full force at the aid barricade into groups of civilians, and they had to like dive out of the way. Those people were hailed as heroes in the media. The Colombian Border Patrol immediately took them in and said, you're ours, and immediately protected them. What's funny is that if people did that here, they would be called terrorists, driving trucks into crowds of civilians at full speed. There, they were heroes. They were heroes defecting from Maduro's army. So that was the first thing that happened. And then the second thing that happened that you guys probably saw if you were tuned into the media was that, quote unquote, the regime burnt the aid trucks. That the aid trucks were set on fire by Maduro and his forces. Well, if you look at an aerial shot of the bridge that these aid trucks were on. They didn't even get close to the Venezuelan side. They were actually just surrounded by these quite wadding barrows toward the Colombian side. Again, masked militant wings of the opposition protesters who were making Molotov cocktails in a literal factory over there. Like, even Bloomberg caught this on camera, and they're like, oh, there's a Molotov cocktail factory. And you can see footage of one of the Guadalupe barrows throwing the Molotov cocktail, and the aid truck explodes. So this was just repeated ad nauseum with zero question whatsoever. The regime lit the aid trucks on fire. What are we going to do about it? That's how crazy these people are. They're burning the aid. I mean, it was just nuts. It's just absolutely insane. Zero evidence. Zero, zero evidence. And then so when this didn't work either, right? So this didn't work. This human chain that they said was going to barge into Venezuela and feed the people, feed the starving masses. There was barely anyone there except these kind of militant protesters at the end of the day. No real protesters, no starving masses, no one who was just really legitimate trying to do this stunt alongside with these U.S. proxies and people like Marco Rubio. So they were so desperate at that point that Marco Rubio just went on some bizarre, unhinged Twitter rant. I don't know if you guys saw this, where he literally posted snuff photos of Muammar Gaddafi in an open threat to Maduro. Literally, like, posted murder shots of Gaddafi getting raped with a sword and murdered in the streets. And I found that reprehensible. We actually started a petition to try to call for his resignation just as a symbolic gesture, because the fact that Ilhan Omar gets widespread condemnation for simply talking about a lobbying force on the Hill. It's all about the Benjamins, baby. This is how AIPAC works. Oh, no. No, 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 no. You're going to get condemned from not only Republicans, not only the entirety of the mainstream media, but your own allies, Democrats. Everyone's going to come down on you and demand an apology or a clarification. Where was the outrage about Marco Rubio threatening to murder a leader? He threatened to murder Nicolas Maduro. Twitter didn't even remove the photos. They didn't censor him at all. There was nothing at all. And in fact, if you looked at the mainstream media the next day, it was like, oh, cryptic tweet sends the world ablaze. Like, what did he mean by this? It's like, I don't know. I think he was calling to murder Maduro. That's what I think the tweet meant. He also posted photos of Manuel Noriega getting arrested. I mean, look, everyone remembers what happened in Panama. Operation Just Cause. 3,000 Panamanians died in that. He's threatening that. And then he went and threatened the Cuban president. We'll see you next. This man is a lunatic. This man is a lunatic. He should immediately resign from Congress. But there's not one peep, not one peep, even from these so-called progressives. Where is the outrage? Where is the outrage? So I just couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. It made me physically ill. Physically ill to see that. So, like I said, I mean, these people are legitimizing the mechanism for regime change now. Like, Elizabeth Warren. She's someone that Trump humiliates every time she's given airtime, every time he's given airtime talking about her, he humiliates her. Yet you would think that someone like her would say, yeah, Trump's disgusting. Obviously, this is a cynical ploy. Even if she were to couch her language in, oh, Maduro needs aid, you would think that she would at least be like, but we can't trust Trump, obviously. But no, she went out there and said, yeah, we need to support this. So it's just very surreal, isn't it? It's kind of revealing that there really is some sort of deep state apparatus that supersedes the partisan politics. And whenever there's kind of this opportunity that arises of a neoconservative regime change plot that has been in the works for decades, everyone lines up in uniformity to make that happen. And it doesn't matter what else is going on, that will happen. And we're seeing it unfold right before our eyes. So again, Maduro is receiving aid. He's receiving aid from countries that are not trying to actively overthrow him. That's the difference. So Bernie Sanders had a town hall. Two of the questions, this shows you how insane our corporate media is. Two of the questions at the town hall were about why won't he call Maduro a dictator? Two questions. Can you imagine at a town hall about being, you know, becoming president with dire issues in this country, failures, complete failures. And he had to like be put on the spot twice. And it wasn't just that. The next day after this town hall, that's all they talked about on CNN. Why didn't he call Maduro a dictator? Well, he's not fit to be president. He should have said Maduro was a dictator. Can you believe that this is the discourse in this country? It's just nuts. So, you know, this isn't just happening, of course, in the big six or maybe even big five now. with the five corporations controlling basically everything that we see, hear, and read. It's the information war, like I said, coup by tweet. It's happening in the social media sphere, and it's unfolding real time on Twitter and on social media.
How could this be? The land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous holocaust, and the home of the slaves. Corporate America, dancing off beat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sponsored terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison. Just because I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brains.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm the host, Mickey Huff. We'd like to now share with you the conclusion of Abby Martin's speech, Critical Media Challenging U.S. Empire. Glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror, but what's reality? Read about the history of the place that we live in, and stop letting corporate news tell lies to your children.
Flow like the blood of Abraham through the Jews and the Arabs, broken apart like a woman's heart, abused in the marriage, the brink of holy war, bottled up like a miscarriage. Embedded correspondents don't tell the source of the tension, and they refuse to even mention European intervention.
So whatever we see online, first of all, it's so dominated by right-wing exiles and pro-coup Venezuelans that it's really hard to, like, kind of sort through that. But you have to understand, in a corporate media structure that's subsidized by big oil, and when Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, you have to also ask yourself, it's not just the NSA, it's not just Russian bots, right? What are corporations doing to employ their own propaganda operations to correct the record themselves? We know from back during the BP oil spill that Darjamal, I think, found out that BP was employing bots, hundreds of bots, to just confuse people online, to take people down who were trying to fight BP. So you have to kind of imagine, right, that that is happening on such a grand scale that we can't even comprehend, while everything's being deflected toward Russian bots and fake news. What are corporations doing? What is the NSA doing? What is the U.S. government doing to shape these narratives online? And also, what's real? What is real and what's not? So tens of millions of dollars are going into these social media operations to steer this line and to embolden the corporate media narrative. Twitter just removed 2,000 pro-Maduro accounts based on no evidence at all that they had anything to do with the government. They said that they were, quote, influencing people. So, you know, under the banner of fighting fake news and Russian propaganda, there's been a massive purge of alternative voices, of grassroots news. And it pretty much started to happen after the 2016 election. Under the banner of fighting fake news and Russian disinfo, that all became one and the same to the blob in D.C. That all became the same. So this traumatic election just made them, basically gave them an opportunity to crack down on dissent and to crack down on anti-establishment voices online. In 2017, the Senate Judiciary Committee made a request to Facebook, Google, and Twitter, Google owns YouTube, remember, to draw up a mission statement to prevent the foment of discord. Now, discord literally means disagreement. That's what it means. So the government asked these tech companies, and there was no law mandating them to do so. They preemptively did this. They acquiesced to the U.S. government without a law. They changed all the algorithms. They backpaged all news, like Project Censored, like Counterpunch, like Empire Files. You can't even find our stuff if you type it on YouTube, unless you go directly to our channel. But that's what they've done. That's what they've done under the banner of fighting Russian disinformation and fake news. They don't care about fighting fake. They are fake news. I mean, the corporate media is the best example of fake news. But if you criticize the U.S. in any way, you're fomenting discord, you're fomenting radical discontent, and you're a useful idiot for the Kremlin. For example, the New York Times, during this coup attempt, the New York Times said, Russia alleges that this is a coup. Russia alleges that this is a coup. So that's a Russian talking point, that this is a coup. Like, that's how far gone we are. And of course, if you know anything about the New York Times, you know, they've supported every coup in history. So that's not surprising. But now it's a Russian talking point. Reality is a Russian talking point. And let's talk about state media really quick, because state media, like Telesaur, like Russia Today, are bemoaned as state propaganda organs, discredited, right? Cartoonishly going along with who's an enemy and who's a friend of the U.S. government. Well, they're state agencies are now enemies and friends of us. So Al Jazeera is now accepted. It used to be called the terrorist network during 9/11. Now that's credible in the eyes of the mainstream. BBC, France 24, they're fine. RT, Telesur, bad. Bad. Well, I think we're mature enough to get the Russian perspective. I want the Russian perspective. I want the Chinese perspective. I want the Middle Eastern perspective. I don't want to look at the world through an ethnocentrist, jingoistic, nationalist lens, especially when we're the world's largest empire that's dominating the rest of the world, subjugating billions of people under our boot. So yeah, I think that we're mature enough to not have our reality curated for us by these tech giants. The fascinating thing about this whole argument, corporate versus state media, is that there's obviously way more freedom at agencies like Telesur and RT. I mean, that's pretty obvious because you look at the corporate media. I think that people like Phil Donahue and Chris Hedges, even, who opposed the Iraq War. I mean, Chris Hedges lost his job at the New York Times. Phil Donahue lost his job at MSNBC. They've been vindicated, right? The Iraq War, biggest crime of the century, million-plus Iraqis dead, destabilized an entire region. They were vindicated, yet they were fired and punished. The people who sold us the war, the neoconservatives, the Iraq War architects, they were rewarded. They're back, baby. They're back with a vengeance. They've never been bigger. Bill Kristol has never been more famous and popular. It's pretty amazing. So the corporate media rewards the propagandists. They reward the war criminals, right? Again, subsidized by defense contractors. That's why you see commercials for Boeing and Lockheed Martin when you're just, like, eating dinner. I mean, we're not buying tanks, so what the f*** is that? So, I mean, it's just such an obvious reflection of who owns the state. You know, why does the corporate media echo the Pentagon? Why? It's not state media. It's not state run. Well, it's a corporate state. It's an oligarchic corporate state. And the interests of those corporations are reflected in the government, right? And that's what the government exists to do. They represent the 1%. They're there to protect and serve the capitalist class, the 0.1%. They're friends and buddies. I mean, I lived in D.C. for years. I know how it is. It's all about access. It's all about access. People are not paid to lie. People join these organizations because they're the, quote, right-thinking journalists. They are groomed and institutionalized in these elite universities and journalism schools, and then they go into these institutions thinking, believing in American exceptionalism. They believe in this stuff. So they call me an activist journalist as if that's like a demeaning slur. But the thing is, they're activist journalists. They're activists on behalf of the U.S. empire. They do activism to protect the corporate line. That's the difference. I think that even during the Iraq War, like I introduced this talk talking about, is that there seemed to even be more diversity during the Iraq War. And I think that it's been consolidated ever more. It's becoming worse every year. And it's reflected in the state of journalism. It's never been more dire. And again, not just the media, but of course in Congress as well, there is no difference of opinion, right? The critique for Trump is coming from the right. It's the critique from the war machine. It's the critique from the generals. Even in Congress, with as much diversity, you know, we all hear about how Congress is the most diverse in history. Well, you really can't find a diversity in opinion about the U.S. war machine, about empire, about ending the 800 bases around the world. Why? Why is that? Simply put, none of this would be able to happen without the media. The U.S. empire is flailing, especially with someone as obtuse as Trump. It is losing its footing, at least its trust in the rest of the world. I'm not looking forward to seeing what the U.S. empire is going to do when it is dying and in the death throes. But none of this would be able to happen so far without the media. Without the media apparatus that paints itself as free. It's constructed and manufactured consent for every single regime change operation, and it will continue to do so. And because of this uniformity and lockstep narrative, even the left, progressive outlets, are so wishy-washy on Venezuela. They're all taking this fake middle ground that literally does not exist. If you talk to Venezuelans in the street, no one's going to say, oh, I don't know. I mean, Maduro's a bad guy, but people are like, we don't want the U.S. here. We will die for the revolution, or, you know, Maduro's a dictator, we'll die for the revolution. That's what it is. That's why a civil war is possible. It is a very stark reality, because that's how divided the country is. So for leftists and people to kind of sit on their ivory towers here and to say, oh, Maduro should have done this, you should have done that, that's not how Venezuelans are thinking. So it's pretty gross to kind of pontificate or be on the record pathologizing the evilness of Maduro before you need to denounce regime change. Don't fall into that game, okay? They do this every time to us, where you first need to denounce Saddam, you need to denounce Maduro, before you can denounce the U.S. government's economic war that's killing people. We're American citizens. That's our duty. If we can't do that, then what good are we? So, sadly, civil war is not the worst possible scenario in Venezuela. Sadly, a U.S. military intervention, a Just Cause 2.0, is the worst possible scenario here. And guess what? It's very likely to happen. Trump is a madman. He's a monster. And his ego is so out of control that I actually can't see him backing down here. Someone asked him, you know, because he's sitting down with Kim Jong-un, why can't you sit down with Maduro? He said it's too far along. The regime change is too far along. We can't back down now. What does that mean? That's why it is so, so crucial for us to be active players, to be involved, to combat the information war, because that's what this is. It is now in the internet. It's online. The war is being waged on our minds. It is an information war, as we know. I mean, it's never been more apparent with the onslaught of propaganda coming from Venezuela. And so we need to be both online and in the streets. It's about time that we build up an actual resistance to the war machine, a genuine anti-war movement, galvanize efforts to combat this, and to force the Progressive Caucus to address this. We need to force their hand. People say I'm being too hard on AOC and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. No, if we're not hard on them, who will be? We need to fight them from the left. We need to force them to admit, yes, we shouldn't have this empire. We shouldn't have these bases. This is where our money's going. We're squandering it all. So this is why the work of Project Censored, what you guys are all involved in, the fact that you guys are even here, that you're involved in activism, is so crucial. The work of independent journalists, independent media, like Project Censored, like Empire Files, are so crucial to support and follow and get involved with. Be a part of this. It's enlightening. It's a beautiful thing. It's the only thing that really gives me hope, frankly, to link up with like minds and to understand that we are doing what we can do on a daily basis to combat this. And it is working, by the way. I meet people every day who say, because of your work on Venezuela, now I understand it. I mean, it gets out there, and we are doing our part as much as we can, and we all need to be a part of this. But it is daunting, right? I mean, the corporate media control, the consolidation, the tech censorship, it's very daunting. But it's a sign of how much grassroots efforts have been able to build up. They've been threatening the hell out of the establishment, and that's why they're doing this, obviously. They know how much of a threat we are. And with the internet, with this egalitarian notion that you can be just as big as CNN, you can combat these narratives and reach the same audience levels. That's what scares the hell out of them. That's why they're locking it down. But we just need to keep going. We need to keep going. Everyone here is involved in doing something very important. Media literacy, social justice work. It's the most critical time for the future of our planet. And with people like you, we are all truly, truly trying to combat, while we're in this regressive, abysmal dystopia, we are all trying to push forward and create progress and create change. And we are active in fighting on the front lines, because this is a war for truth. It is a war for truth. And no matter how much they want us to feel alone and isolated in our beliefs and activism, tens of millions stand shoulder to shoulder to us, with us. The truth will prevail. And the more we lift each other up and embolden that truth, the weaker the U.S. empire will become. Thanks so much, you guys. And if anyone has any questions, yeah.
What are your thoughts on Tulsi Gabbard's campaign?
Thank you for bringing her up, because she is the only, she's pretty much the only one that's not couching her rhetoric in like, Maduro's evil. But we shouldn't intervene. She's actually saying we should not intervene. This is outrageous. The neoconservatives and neoliberals are fomenting this, and it's completely crazy. And I really respect her and appreciate her for that a lot. I would love to hear her clarify her stance on torture and Israel, considering she was at AIPAC 2 years ago. But I think that right now she's definitely the best that we have on the campaign trail to combat the coup and regime change wars. And I am so excited that she'll be out there on the debate stage really pushing that dialogue to the left. That's super crucial right now. Yeah, so I'm really happy she's out there, and I hope she really keeps them on their toes. But yeah, she's getting... It's amazing to see how smeared she is getting for simply just saying she didn't want war in Syria. You Assadist! Why do you love Assad? Like, why do you love Assad, Tulsi? I mean, it's just... It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, what do you think we should be doing about the closing down of the open society that we see in these changes to the Google algorithms and Facebook, shutting down pages and what seems to be their own filtering of certain posts that have certain links? That seems like just an incredibly dangerous thing that we have to confront.
It is very dangerous, and it's affected a ton of people and really had a lot of good organizations take a hit. And a lot of people have lost a lot of funding structures. And I think that the absolute best thing that we can do is join mailing lists. Directly follow the journalists and organizations that you wish to see. We have to go back to before social media, before we bought in and invested so much of our time and energy, because it really can be shut down in a heartbeat.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I am Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program, along with Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about the work, to find any of our previous archived programs, please go to projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Prepared about criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured, paid for by taxes, by the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we got
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Extinction Rebellion, Dr. Rupert Reed. In October 2018, about 100 academics signed a call to action. They established Extinction Rebellion in the United Kingdom. The movement has become international, with Naomi Klein, Vandana Shiva, and Noam Chomsky signing their support to the second letter. The goal of Extinction Rebellion is to use nonviolent resistance to bring about radical change to prevent climate collapse, loss of biodiversity, and to reduce the risk of human extinction. Dr. Rupert Reed is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's a longtime Green Party politician and former Green Party spokesperson for transport. Here's a talk he gave on February 6, 2019, at the University of East Anglia.
Let me start by telling you a story of a species that was asleep. And when it woke up, it saw the doom that it had created already for so many other species, and that it had now trapped itself on a path of self-imposed death. It saw its own doom, and it trembled in fear, and it wept. But then it realized that it wasn't fully awake yet. There was a further step it had to take to become awakened, to become enlightened. And that was to realize, hang on a minute, we're not spectators of this. This story isn't over yet. It's wrong to tell it as if it's over. We can rebel against this doom, against this path to extinction. If we see clearly what we've done, the state we're in, the path ahead, the doom that seems inevitable, well, that seeing is the beginning of the one and only way in which it might yet not be inevitable. Because we're not spectators. We are agents. We are potential agents of change, and we have no idea what we are capable of until we try. We can rebel against the very predictable results of our present path. If we dare to look the reality of what we've done to life on Earth and what we've done to our very climate in the face, then two things. Firstly, we can prepare for our possible doom. And if we're potentially going to fail to prevent that doom, as looks objectively probable, then we'd better get on with preparing to meet it. And secondly, we can prepare ourselves to seek to give our all to prevent it. This talk is about those two kinds of preparations, about adaptation to a possible coming fate, and about the heroic attempt to prevent that fate. This talk is about how it looks like we're doomed, but also about how it only looks like that, only if we only look, if we picture ourselves as spectators. But if instead we step into our full power as agents of change, capable of extraordinary, beautiful, unprecedented, unknowable things, then objective assessment of probabilities suddenly all becomes moot. And instead it's about our freedom to create something new, something historic, something glorious, right in the teeth of the darkness of this time. But first, why think that a sober assessment of probabilities would lead us to conclude that we are doomed? Won't international action save us from climate catastrophe? No. Sorry. The answer is no. Let me spend a little while talking with you about why the Paris Climate Change Agreement will not save us. So the Paris Climate Change Agreement, a few years ago now, was an absolutely historic, unprecedented, extraordinary diplomatic achievement. Every country in the world had to agree for this climate agreement to be made. And they did. And what they agreed to was really about the most that you could expect the countries of the world all together to agree to. They agreed to work together to make changes to reduce our carbon emissions so that we don't destroy ourselves. Very good so far. But there are some problems, some very, very big problems, which I'm now going to briefly outline. So let's start with the fact that this was a few years ago. What have we had since then? Since then, we've had growing scientific evidence of how desperate our plight is, including, for example, the huge amount of heat that's trapped in the oceans, much huger than we realise, which is committing us to further dangerous climate change for a long time to come. We've seen our weather start to really spiral out of control just in those last few years since Paris, and that's part of what's waking a lot of people up to what's happening. And perhaps worst of all, we've seen, absolutely incredibly at this moment in history, we've seen the election of Donald Trump in the USA and of Bolsonaro in Brazil, about the two worst leaders you could possibly imagine in about the two most important countries in the entire world for dealing with this awesome crisis. So things have got a lot worse since the Paris Agreement was signed, tragically, on balance. But it's worse than that, because even on its own terms, the Paris Agreement is profoundly inadequate to the situation that we're in. Firstly, the Paris Agreement basically aims to keep our global climate to within 2 degrees of overheat compared to pre-industrial levels. But most scientists think that isn't actually a safe level. That's why more recently they've been talking about 1.5 degrees, which is pretty much of an impossible target. So even what Paris is aiming for is not enough. The way that Paris intends us to get there is through voluntary contributions to that target by countries around the world. Voluntary contributions, bit of a worry there. And those contributions, you add them all up, and people have done this, and they add up to considerably less than is necessary to keep us within 2 degrees. They probably take us to somewhere around 3 degrees of global overheat. It doesn't end there. Unfortunately, these are simply targets. These are aspirations made, as I say, voluntarily by the governments of the world. But you have to ask yourself this question. If those aspirations run up against other plans that those governments have, which is going to win? So one way of posing the question is to think of it like this. On the one hand, you've got the climate change minister saying, well, that we signed up to these targets in Paris. And on the other hand, you've got the business minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying, yeah, and this is what we need for economic growth and infrastructure development and so on. Now, when you have the climate change minister on the one hand arguing against the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the business minister on the other hand, well, I leave it to you to figure out who's going to win that one. Most countries of the world, just about all countries in the world, have plans for industrial growth, for economic growth, for infrastructure growth, which directly contradict their voluntary agreement under the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Extremely worrying. But that's not the end of it. The IPCC process itself, the UN process itself, needs to be critiqued. You may not be aware that the summary documents which the IPCC comes up with are not produced by scientists. They're produced by, or at least they're edited, by politicians and civil servants. This is not an objective process. Moreover, even the IPCC bit, the scientists bit themselves, the scientists have to agree among themselves, and this is a kind of process of a sort of lowest common denominator. Mostly what you have in the IPCC reports is a sort of bare minimum of what we can expect in terms of how bad things are going to be. Leading-edge predictions of how bad things could be rarely get in there, and it's those that we should be worried about now. Why is that? Another reason why the IPCC process itself is problematic is because it doesn't take proper account of feedbacks. In the recent 1.5 degree report, for example, there was virtually nothing about the fact that the Arctic ice cap, as you probably know, is melting. And this is meaning that there is less whiteness reflecting the sun's rays out back into space again. And you're starting to get a vicious feedback there. As more of the sun's rays come in and hit dark sea, more of them get absorbed, and that increases the temperature further, and then more ice melts, and you see where that's going. That's not even the scariest feedback. The scariest feedback, which is completely ignored almost in the IPCC process, is the potential methane feedback. As we melt the permafrost especially, and as we melt ice also under the seabed, we are starting to release significant amounts of methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas that is somewhere between 25 and 86 times, depends how you calculate, as powerful as carbon dioxide. And some scientists are worried that once this methane effect starts really going, it will be uncontrollable and we'll have runaway climate change. You put all these points together, and what it suggests is that on the Paris trajectory, we're headed for something like 4 degrees, 5 degrees of global overheat, probably this century. That is incompatible with civilization as we know it. That is incompatible with an industrial growth-based society. And I haven't even mentioned possibly the worst thing of all, the really dirty secret about the Paris Agreement, which is to reach its targets later on this century, it presupposes that we will use the technologies of so-called climate engineering or geoengineering, the idea that we can engineer the climate of the whole planet, an extremely, how shall we put it, bold ambition. There are two problems with the technologies proposed for this bold ambition. The first is that they don't exist. And that's more or less a literal statement of fact. The only ones that do exist haven't been trialled at scale, and there's very little reason to believe that they would work at scale. Secondly, if they were used at scale, if they were trialled, well, it would be an extremely, extremely reckless thing to do. We're talking about things like putting mirrors in space. We're talking about things like attempting to suck vast amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, or attempting to replicate natural cloud effects with artificial clouds that could radically alter our weather. These technologies, these techno-fixes, are incredibly dangerous and reckless. So the first problem with these technologies, which are presupposed by the Paris Agreement, is that they don't exist. And the second problem is that if they did exist, we almost certainly shouldn't use them. So what conclusion should one draw from this? Well, I already said it. If we stick to what's intended under the Paris Agreement, then during this century and possibly during the next generation, this civilization will be finished. Industrial growth society will be over. We're talking about collapse. We're talking about the potential for a series of events which will make the Second World War look relatively minor. This is about whether we, and especially anyone younger than about 30 or 40 in this room, has a future. Industrial growth society is finished. It is doomed. If we manage to go along with what is intended under the Paris Agreement, never mind if we don't achieve it, the best ambitions that our governments have for us mean that the societies that they run are finished. They are not going to be sustained. They are doomed. But the fact that they are doomed have to mean that we are doomed. That is the question that we now must turn to. It seems to me that in this situation, there are three possibilities. There are three realistic possibilities for the form that the end of industrial growth society will take. It's going to happen. Which of these three scenarios will play out? The first scenario I've already gestured at, that our societies will collapse completely, that this incredibly thin layer, which is our atmosphere, will continue to heat up, and that will not be compatible with life as we know it. In particular, the first thing that is likely to give, although there are many possibilities, is our food systems. We already got a little hint of that last summer. Imagine if the heat wave that we'd had last summer had gone on, as it quite easily could have done, on into September. We were already getting major crop losses. One little example, onion crop in East Anglia down 25 to 30%. How many summers like that can the vast numbers that we have sustain? This is the first possibility, and I put it first because objectively, it now looks like it's the most likely. But here's the second possibility, and this may not sound great, but actually, I think it's quite exciting in some ways and quite realistic. Maybe we will manage to seed a successor society to it, to what we have, as this society collapses. And that is now something that we have to give serious attention to thinking about. It's not enough anymore to pretend that if we just keep trying to mitigate climate change in the way we have been doing, that we are going to succeed in saving ourselves and saving some version of this society. We have to consider the possibility of some kind of massive collapse event, and we have to think about how we can try to help whatever comes after that if anything comes after that, if we manage to have anything come after that, if we don't get some kind of runaway dangerous climate change produced by the methane feedback, for example. We have to think about what that could be like and how we could foster it. This is a picture of the seed bank at Svalbard, which some of you will be aware of, which tries to keep seeds, large numbers of diverse seeds, intact for possible future generations to use after some kind of collapse event. Now, tragically, what happened recently, as some of you will have heard, is that the Svalbard seed bank started to melt. Because Svalbard, many of you will know about Svalbard, for example, from Philip Pullman's marvellous Northern Lights book, Land of Snow and Ice, but the Arctic has been exposed to these absolutely insane temperatures over the last year, 20 or 30 degrees above seasonal normals. So the seed bank started to melt and emergency work was needed to keep it intact. We have to think about how to keep this kind of thing intact, how to do it even more creatively. Various ways, this is just an example, of how we can try to help whoever may come after us if this society collapses to rebuild something different and better. That's the second possibility, and I'm saying we need to think about it more than we have done so far. The third possibility, this society will somehow manage to transform itself. We will somehow manage to transform ourselves radically and rapidly in an unprecedented manner in time to avert collapse. So industrial growth society as we know it is finished, but that doesn't have to mean that there has to be a collapse event in which there are multiple holocausts. It could be averted if we do something completely unprecedented, and that's what I call transformation. So we should aim for this possibility, number three, but we should also, as an insurance policy, take action that conduces to possibility number two being available, and to try to avoid, at all costs, possibility number one. So, those three possibilities, which are we going to plump for? What is to be done? Given this situation, what is to be done? I'm going to suggest seven things that we need to do in this unprecedented historic challenge that we now face. Firstly, there we go. Wake up, freak out. Hopefully you're already doing a bit of that, the very fact that you're here, and then the fact you've heard what I've said so far. And of course, it's not enough just for you as an individual to wake up. Try to get all your friends and family and workmates, teachers, whoever it might be, to wake up and to freak out as well. The more of us who do it together, the more of an impact there's going to be. This is not something which is easy to do, it's not a kind of one-off event. It's very easy to think, I've woken up to this, I've acknowledged that this is the reality, and then to keep on sliding back into the assumption that we can just sort of go on with our lives most of the time in the same way that we do. If you're really going to do this, it's going to require a lot of thought, a lot of concentration, and then starting to think about which of your practices you want to change. You know, what things do you want to give up? What things do you want to, for example, maybe do now rather than later? Because there might not be a later in the way you've imagined. Secondly, so I've already gestured at this, work to transform the society, including through what my think tank Greenhouse, following the UN, calls transformative adaptation. Why am I talking about transformative adaptation? What does that mean? Well, as I've already said, it is no longer enough for us to think, when we think about dangerous climate change, only about climate mitigation. That is no longer credible. We are now committed to dangerous climate change, which is going to get worse for a long time to come, whatever we do, even if we do the absolute best we can. Because as I gestured at a little while ago, there are time lags in the system. There is this vast amount of heat in the ocean. Methane lasts 20, 25 years in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide lasts hundreds of years in the atmosphere. If we were to stop all emissions tomorrow, the climate situation would go on getting worse for a considerable time to come. Right? It is not credible anymore to think, yes, we just have to solve this problem. We just have to stop producing so many emissions. No, we are going to have to adapt. And we're going to have to adapt in this way, which we call transformative, because the kind of shallow adaptation The kind of mainstream adaptation which is involved in doing things like just building higher dikes or seawalls, for example, to deal with flood risks, that isn't good enough. Why isn't that good enough? Firstly, it's not good enough because it's actually productive itself of greenhouse gas emissions, right? We have to think of ways of adapting which are simultaneously ways of mitigating if we're not going to make the situation worse and worse, yeah? We can't adapt in ways that are themselves fossil fuel heavy. And secondly, we have to be fleet-footed in our adaptation. We have to try to create a society which is going to be ready for continual change in our climate and difficult situations for a long time to come. We are in the early stages of a very long emergency. And to get through that emergency, we're going to have to adapt to the difficult changes that are coming, and we're going to have to do so transformatively, in a way that ultimately transforms our society into the kind of flourishing, very different society that we need. But that actually isn't enough. We also have to accept that this effort to transform society may well fail. Because as I started out by sketching, the situation is very grim, and we are facing massive forces of ignorance, massive forces of vested interests which are going to find it very difficult to adapt. We have to face the reality that we've left this all awfully late. We may well fail. We may well fail to transformatively adapt, let alone to mitigate adequately. Therefore, we also need what my friend and colleague Jim Bendel calls deep adaptation. What is deep adaptation? Adaptation that is deep is adaptation that accepts, at least hypothetically, that collapse is probable. Or highly probable, or some people, they think it's inevitable. So deep adaptation says, what if we do experience a collapse event? What then? So this is like the kind of thinking that I talked about a few minutes ago when I talked about we have to think about how to seed a successor civilization. So deep adaptation says things like, okay, if society does start to collapse, what kind of things will we need to do to stop that collapse from becoming self-fulfilling, from becoming worse and worse? So here's one very prominent example. Some people think that nuclear power is a way which we might be able to help ourselves solve the problem of greenhouse gas emissions and high fossil fuel use and growth in global temperatures. But when you look at the issue that we're facing from the perspective of thinking, we have to start to face up to the possibility that there may well be some kind of collapse event, nuclear power starts to look completely different, right? Because nuclear power produces waste that remains toxic for, well, hundreds of thousands of years, and highly toxic for hundreds of years. And it needs to be carefully guarded during that period. I don't just mean guarded against terrorists, although that's obviously one thing it needs to be guarded against. I mean, you've got literally rods of spent fuel, which are in pools, and these pools have to be kept there constantly. If the pool goes dry, then within about 12 to 24 hours, the spent fuel rods will catch fire. And if they catch fire and the fire is not put out, the fires will burn for decades or hundreds of years, spewing toxic waste into the atmosphere. So picture some kind of collapse event across Russia, say, where suddenly all the nuclear power stations are abandoned and they cease to have power going to them, they cease to be maintained. In very, very short order, you get not only meltdowns of cores of nuclear power stations, but just the waste that is left over starts to become an unbelievably potent and horrendous health hazard for ourselves and our non-human kin. This is the kind of thing that we need to be thinking about now if we seriously believe, as I've suggested we must, that collapse is objectively probable or at least something which we need to very seriously consider. So we need to be thinking now about how to make these nuclear power stations safe, not for God's sake building more, and about how we can make nuclear waste relatively safe. That is a prime example of deep adaptation. Deep adaptation is sort of an ultimate insurance policy. It says, given that we now cannot rule out, at the very least, we cannot rule out that there may be some kind of major prolonged collapse event, partially or completely, we need to be taking steps now to try to put ourselves and whoever comes after us in the best possible position to survive that kind of event. So that's the third thing. Not just transformative adaptation, but deep adaptation. Fourthly, well, by this point in the talk, maybe you're upset. Maybe you're feeling angry. Maybe you're feeling grief. Maybe you're feeling terror. Well, whatever it is, feel it. And this is one of the very things which I think is very exciting about Extinction Rebellion, that it has gone against the mainstream in environmental thinking. For so long, people have been saying things like, oh, we've got to tell a positive story, we've got to remain optimistic, we've got to convince everybody that we can change everything for the better, and it's not going to be that difficult. And if we all just make a real effort and put in low-energy light bulbs, then basically everything's going to be fine. And even if it's not, we've got to pretend that it is, because if you get people scared, they will turn off, they'll become apathetic. No, forget all of that. Now is the time for authenticity. Now is the time for telling the truth. Now is the time for being real about how bad this is and using our feelings, right? And not just pretending that some kind of rational policy wonk fantasy is going to solve this, because it's not. So feel your anger, feel your grief, whatever it is. Feel your despair. Don't get stuck in it, but feel it. And then work through it. Feel your terror. And when you've done all that, then you're in the best position to do this. Rebel. The time is now for mass, non-violent, direct action. We've tried plenty of other stuff, and I'm not saying don't do that other stuff. Yeah, sure. Continue to write to your MP, continue to lobby, continue, obviously, to try to live lightly upon the earth. Rob mentioned that I'm in the Green Party. I think that ordinary political action continues to be very important. I personally would say to you, join the Green Party, vote Green, stand for election, whatever. That's all really, really good. It's all really, really necessary. We need everything. But don't be fooled into thinking that those things alone, those conventional things, are going to be enough. They're not going to be enough. We need an absolute step change. We need it rapidly, and we need it for a long time. And the best idea that we have is this. The best idea that we have is to say, the societies that are committing us to oblivion, the governments that are committing us to oblivion, the governments that are planning, when you look at the realities of the Paris Climate Change Accord, that are planning for the self-destruction of the societies which they've created and which we depend upon, these governments are no longer legitimate, right? How can a government be legitimate which is engaged in a sort of mass criminal conspiracy to not only destroy even more of the non-human life on Earth? We've destroyed half the non-human life on Earth during my lifetime. And it's so unbelievable and so tragic. You can say it as many times as you like, and it's almost impossible to compute. So there's that, and then the fact that we are now putting ourselves on the endangered species list. How can such governments expect us to go along with their laws any longer? It is time, it is high time, it is past time for us to say no, and for us to be freed up from the assumptions of political business as usual by the awesome horror of the situation that we now find ourselves in.
That was part one of a longer talk and conversation with Dr. Rupert Weed. He's teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia and has been a longtime Green Party politician and a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Come back when TUC Radio returns for part of the conversation with the audience. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And it was Lee Morgan, and it is Sidewinder. And we're joined now, I believe, by Stephen Gowans of gowans.wordpress.com. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Well, we're glad to be talking to you because we seem to have this issue of Venezuela from so many aspects to this crisis that seems to be artificially created by Washington, largely. You've taken up one aspect of it, this shocking kind of event where, I guess, the past few days there's been power outage. I think in 23 out of 26 states of Venezuela, they lost power for a significant period of time. And the government of Venezuela says that they've been a victim of cyber war, I believe is the term. And but, of course, a more authoritative voice, Senator Rubio, says that, no, it's because Maduro doesn't know how to manage electricity or something. And you, in your column, say that you would not dismiss Maduro's allegations out of hand. Why do you say that?
Yeah. And they are dismissed out of hand, certainly by the Canadian and U.S. media, who kind of, I mean, they present it this way. There goes Maduro, you know, this crazy dictator, as they call him, with his conspiracy theory about the United States unleashing a cyber weapon, when really, isn't it more reasonable to suggest that this is just another instance of Maduro's economic mismanagement? And what struck me is, and also the Canadian and U.S. press have been pointing out that Maduro is making this cyber warfare claim without presenting any evidence, which struck me as being particularly rich, since the Western media is chock-a-block of claims without any evidence. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. We could go on for days naming all the cases in which the U.S. and Western media have talked about, for example, the Skripal affair, where there is absolutely no evidence produced to implicate the Russians, but the argument is made, well, who else could it be? Yeah. Well, there are cases. I mean, we have the accusations that were hurled against the Syrian government that it was involved in the use of chemical weapons, again, with no evidence, and it just goes on and on. In this particular case, however, the media is making the claim that that the power outages are attributable to the mismanagement of the Maduro government. Well, that's a claim that's provided without evidence as well. So I looked at this and said, well, we have a fact. The fact is power outages, and we have two narratives. One comes from Canada and the U.S. that says this is attributable to Maduro's inefficiencies. And the other coming from the Venezuelan government attributing the power outages to a cyber weapon attack. So I decided to look at this from the perspective of, you know, both explanations to see which is more credible, recognizing that, you know, there's no evidence available to me or you that allow us to distinguish which is in fact, or any definitive evidence to make a claim. But as I looked at this, I recalled a story I had read and kept from, I think it was 2017 or 2018. It was a story from the New York Times by David Sanger. And David Sanger had talked about the United States having a secret program codenamed Nitro Zeus, which called for turning off the power grid in much of Iran if the two countries had found themselves in a conflict over Iran's nuclear power program. And he went on to say that such a use of cyber weapons is now a key element in the war planning of all the major world powers. So if the United States could do this to Iran, it could certainly easily do it to Venezuela. So the United States has the capability to undertake this kind of cyber weapons attack. By the way, the Sanger article had the headline, U.S. declines to sign declaration discouraging use of cyber attacks. And this is in connection with the so-called tariff call for trust and security in cyber space, which the French President Macron was putting together. He got 51 countries to sign this declaration. The United States refused to sign. And they refused to sign, said on the grounds that American presidents and American officials should never be forced to give up a tool that could be used to intervene in the elections of other countries. Which is quite interesting. After they are complaining about, again, with no evidence that the United or that Russia has been interfering in the elections of the United States.
They refuse to be to answer any questions whether they do that because nobody can constrain them. Amazing.
And then it struck me that the United States has used cyber weapons in at least two occasions, used the cyber attacks to sabotage Iran's uranium enrichment program, which is now widely acknowledged.
It's called STYX or something, STYX or something.
Stutniks,
Yeah, Stutniks. I'm sorry, Stutniks, right.
And it has also used cyber warfare to sabotage the North Koreans' rocket program. This, too, was revealed by Sanger in the New York Times. So they have the capability, and they have the history of doing this kind of thing. Since I wrote the article, I've discovered that there was an article written just recently in Forbes magazine, hardly a supporter of the Maduro government.
It's no longer a Marxist journal, yes.
No, and this is written by a guy who's a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber Homeland Security. And he made the argument that, in fact, as he put it, quote, this kind of, or the idea of a foreign nation manipulating an adversary's power grid to force a government transition is very real. And he went on to say that widespread power and connectivity issues, like the one Venezuela experienced last week, are straight from the modern cyber playbook. Interestingly, he points out that timing such an outage to occur at the moment of societal upheaval in a way that delegitimizes the current government, exactly as a government in waiting has presented itself as a ready alternative, is exactly the kind of tactics that were discussed in the security establishment in 2015. So, I mean, so the...
Is it what they call a prima facie case going on here?
Yeah, and what struck me was the timing of all of this. If it is the case that the power outages are attributable to, you know, years and years of mismanagement by the Maduro government, it seems strangely convenient that suddenly this has all come to a head precisely at the point that the United States is trying to bring about a coup d'etat. But as pointed out in Forbes, I mean, this kind of program would be necessarily coordinated with, you know, a program in which you have a government in waiting, ready to step in.
We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. What's left in the article is about this examination of the claims and counterclaims between the U.S. and President Maduro. Of course, you also point out in the article that we're dealing with some pretty frank gentlemen in the White House. We've got Elliot Abrams, and you quote John Bolton, who's proud, and it's rare in these days that American leaders say, oh, yes, the Monroe Doctrine is absolutely contemporary. I mean, that should... Well, of course, it also raises, and I don't know if you want to agree to how far to get into it, but I don't understand why Canada and other countries don't say to the U.S., well, actually, we don't agree with the Monroe Doctrine, did not at the time, and not now. But that's, again, part of the evidence, is it not?
Yeah, it is part of the evidence. It's part of the evidence about the motivation. The United States has a motivation to undertake a cyber warfare attack. So it has the capability. It's done so in the past. It has the motivation in the case of Venezuela. So there's nothing really unusual or about the possibility that this kind of attack has been undertaken. Now, of course, we can't say for sure that it has. But even if it hasn't, I mean, the alternative explanation, and a reasonable alternative explanation that's being offered, is that maybe this is attributable to failures to do adequate maintenance on the power grid or failure to invest in the power grid. But if that's so, these things would be a consequence of this very vigorous economic war that the United States and Canada and the European Union have been waging on Venezuela. And it's a very vigorous war. In fact, you know, a senior State Department official said last year, I mean, quoting, "The financial sanctions we've placed on the Venezuelan government, what we're seeing is a total economic collapse in Venezuela. So our policy is working, our strategy is working, and we're going to keep it on the Venezuelans." Well, when you pursue that kind of economic warfare, well, maybe it would be the case that you do inadequate maintenance on your power grid. Maybe you don't invest appropriately in the power grid and it breaks down. So even if it wasn't a cyber weapons attack and it was attributable to failure to maintain the power grid, that still goes back to decisions made by the United States and Canada and the EU to wage a war against this country, wage a war to change the regime to bring in a regime that's more amenable to U.S. and Canadian free enterprise.
Yeah. I should ask you about that too. Is it this is a demonstration once again that that the U.S. There's a kind of story that Trump is retreating. He's circling the wagons. He's given up on foreign policy. But he got Germany to line up. He got France to line up. Britain lined up. Israel lined up. All condemning Maduro, calling for well, I guess the reckoning. Pardon me, but recognition of Guaido, which is. I mean, it's highly perilous stuff to be doing. You're talking about regime change nakedly. But all these parties, Canada, they all lined up. It seems to show that the U.S. is interested in throwing its weight around and others are interested in following along behind.
Yes, in Canada, as you point out, Canada, the rule of law nation, which is engaged in illegal sanctions against Venezuela, illegal on two grounds. First, they're illegal according to the UN Charter because these have been imposed without UN Security Council approval, and also illegal under the Organization of American States Charter. So I don't know how it is that Canada can keep boasting about being a rule of law state.
Maybe they only mean domestically. When they get out and they leave town, they really kind of – it's like being in Vegas.
Yes, more an outlaw state.
No, that's appalling. I mean, that incidentally, that raises the issue. I want to ask you about this. I spoke earlier to Dimitri Lascaris about this. The Lima Group, which Canada seems to be proudly sort of a leader of, acts like a leader of, they seem highly destructive of the Organization of American States, which has. You know, their charter says no intervention and no sanctions, but the Lima Group is they're like a faction trying to destroy the OAS.
Yeah, that's exactly, or in this case, I mean, it was simply an ad hoc group assembled and put together in order to do something that couldn't be done within the legally anyway, within the context of the OAS. So they couldn't. Under the OAS charter, impose sanctions on Venezuela. So they said, well, let's form our own little group of those people who are willing to do so or willing to try and undermine the government of Venezuela. And
yeah. And the media follows by continually talking about the Lima Group. The Lima Group is just a faction inside the OAS.
Yeah.
And the OAS is no longer talked about. Everybody here just says, oh, the Lima Group. Well, it's just a gang. By the way, a lot of unscrupulous characters play a leading part, starting with Mr. Bolsonaro, who's pretty not shy about fascistic behavior. And on the question of ideology, I got to get to this matter. The word socialism is being thrown around a lot, particularly I'd like to say the socialist government of Maduro. You have a quibble with that that is rather helpful. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's interesting that they keep calling it the socialist government of Maduro, and suddenly we're to believe that Venezuela is a socialist country. I think it's more accurately described as a resource naturalist, resource nationalist country, and that's the issue. There would be an issue if it was a socialist country. That's
yeah.
For sure.
The power grid we're talking about is private, right?
Yes. And then much of the economy is private. Mm-hmm. This is the way that Bolton has been describing Venezuela, and using the most florid language, unbelievable language. I mean, talking about Venezuela belonging to a troika of tyranny, forming part of a triangle of terror, acting as a sordid cradle of communism in the Western Hemisphere. We have Trump, of course, talking about Venezuela as a socialist state and the breakdown of the economy becoming an object lesson in, you know, the inefficiencies and the problems of socialism. We'll never allow socialism because look what happens when you have socialism. The mm-hmm. entire economy breaks down and the power grid doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But this goes on and on in country after country in which the United States intervenes by means of economic warfare. They deliberately bring down an economy, create massive upheaval, chaos, disarticulation, and then they invariably attribute it, with great assistance of the media, to economic mismanagement or socialism or their communist policies. And suddenly, the effects of the sanctions and the economic warfare disappear, and we don't hear about that. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, this is what the United States has done or did in Cuba, and there's an historian who I cited in that article mm-hmm. Who had unearthed the U.S. foreign policy documents in which, principles Cuba or U.S. Policy toward Cuba talked about how it was necessary to use economic measures to impose or to cripple the Cuban economy, but at the same time it was necessary to hide the hand of the United States and to attribute the breakdown of the economy to Castro.
That was his language, how they would hiding the hand, and we'll put the blame on Fidel.
Yeah, exactly. So in Cuba, the United States sabotaged the economy through sanctions and the blockade, and deliberately tried to pin the blame on Castro and socialism, as they said, knowing exactly what they were doing. And in this case, in Venezuela, the United States appears to have sabotaged the electrical grid, either through a cyber warfare attack or indirectly through the economic warfare it's been waging. Mm-hmm. And it's pinning the blame on Maduro and on socialism.
Mm-hmm. It's really a remarkable story. By the way, I spoke earlier with Dimitri about the story of the bridge. You must have seen that story today. The New York Times now says 2 weeks after the event. Always, I guess Mark Twain says a lie is halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. We were very close to something quite, warlike conditions between Colombia, Brazil, and Venezuela. We had U.S. military aircraft with Elliot Abrams aboard arriving and running at the border of Venezuela. And then to make it really inflammatory, they set fire to a truck and put the blame on Maduro, but today's Times said that actually not only did they set the fire from the Colombian side, but also the actual footage of it, which they circulated around the world and caused Freeland and others to speak out on, was edited, clumsily, I assume, in which minutes were taken out so that you couldn't see the actor who did it and the time frame that was – they just eliminated the time frame and so that it appeared – you know, you couldn't see that it was this individual. Went to an awful lot of trouble to do a fake story. But look at our gullibility. Nobody in Parliament said anything. We're still on board with the story that everything is Maduro's fault. Have you followed that event, and have you got any comment on it?
Yeah, you're right. They're still on board. It's going to do little, at least in the mainstream media, to derail the program of talking about restoring democracy in Venezuela and overthrowing a dictator. By the way, the last time I was on your show, when we were talking about Venezuela, you talked about the Albert Einstein Institute and how it had been involved in Venezuela. And I was looking back at my notes, and what struck me about this is in 2003, the Albert Einstein Institute, funded by the United States through the National Endowment for Democracy, was training an overthrow movement within the country. But interestingly, the concepts they were using are exactly the same ones they're using today, which was they were trying to restore democracy and overthrow a dictator. In this case, it was Chavez rather than Maduro. So the story hasn't changed. The narrative remains the same, just that the style of intervention has changed. Mm-hmm. It's escalated.
Mm-hmm. And this individual, Guaido, he actually had some experience with that, right? He attended meetings, I think they were in, was it Yugoslavia? There was a country once called Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, and OTPAR was the group that the NAD had trained, or the Albert Einstein trained in, to do exactly the same thing, to disrupt and to the Yugoslav government in order to bring it down. And what they did was they brought in two of the leaders of OTPAR to help train Venezuelan students. And there's some evidence to suggest that Guaido was one of the people that was being trained.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the Wall Street Journal has been talking about Guaido today and using another kind of deception, saying, well, you know, they say that Guaido is just a puppet of the United States, but don't you know that he represents a party that's in the Socialist International?
Yeah, I saw that in the Globe. Well, you spoke about his socialist program. I think you mentioned that Mr. Guaido favors privatization and talked to the Americans about their running the oil business. I guess that's a socialist program. What do you make of that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was Bolton on Fox Business talking about how this is going to be great if they get Guaido in. You know, the United States oil companies will be able to invest in Venezuelan oil. And his program, that is Guaido's program, is the same as Bolton's, which is essentially to open up Venezuelan resources, oil and gold and everything else to U.S. free enterprise. So, yeah, perhaps those are the programs that are, promoted by parties in the Socialist International today. But
they live in this fantasy world. I have to say, I mean, we've talked about this before, but actually, if I read The Star about twice a week, I see a cartoon in which Putin has Trump in his lap giving him instructions. And nobody says, are you out of your mind? I mean, what's Putin's plan to put Guaido in power? Is this a socialist party? Is the Wall Street Journal onto something? You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen Gowans, it's great to talk to you. That's a wonderful article, gowans.wordpress.com. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Phil.
Okay. This is The Taylor Report, and it is CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, thetaylorreport@ciut.fm. We're on Facebook, / The Taylor Report, and we're SoundCloud, thetaylor-report.com.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.